You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
For instance, type 2 diabetes. I was starting to find type 2 diabetes in crocodiles. And why would a crocodile have a genetic disease of humans, right? Maybe he ate a Baptist preacher in Africa that had diabetes and got the gene that way. Well, it's a silly thing, but that's what doctors were proposing. Well, it turns out that all vertebrates, regardless if they're a reptile or a bird or a mammal or a rat or a human, all vertebrates, if they have a nutritional deficiency, will get the same disease from the same nutritional deficiency.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Joel Wallach. Today's show, a stick of butter a day keeps the doctor away. Dr. Wallach is a veterinarian, naturopathic physician, and holds a postdoctorate fellowship in comparable pathology, as well as being an author and lecturer. He is the author of many books, including Dead Doctors Don't Lie, Epigenetics, The Death of the Genetic Theory of Disease Transmission, Black Gene Lies, and Rhino Express, The Saving of the White Rhino. Today we discuss Dr. Wallach's groundbreaking comparative pathology study of American, Canadian, and Mexican zoo animals funded by the National Institutes of Health, which led to the authorship of Diseases of Exotic Animals. Epigenetics, the study of environmental effects on gene expression and the role that nutrition plays in the prevention of degenerative diseases. Dr. Joel Wallach, welcome.
Well, thank you, Bonnie. Appreciate your hospitality.
You've written many books. Probably the most well-known is entitled Dead Doctors Don't Lie. That's a catchy title. What does it refer to?
Well, Bonnie, when I started treating humans, remember, I'm a veterinarian as well as a physician. So when I started treating humans, I wanted to look at the record of the medical system and see how well they were doing. And I just went to the medical school and just reached in, got an armful of the Journals of the American Medical Association, and added up the death age of the obituaries of 200 doctors divided by 200 and got 58. And I said, oh, my gosh. The average lifespan of medical doctors is 58. Why would anybody want to listen to them on how to live a long, healthy life? That's certainly not a good example. And so I said, only dead doctors don't lie, because if they're taking their own treatments, I don't want their treatment because their average lifespan is 58. That's where it came from.
So you're saying that they're not lying because they're dead?
Well, that's the only time a doctor won't lie is when he's dead, because he can't lie, right? And so when you look at the medical theories that they've been using for the last 5,000 years, every century there's thousands of failed medical theories. In the 20th century, Bonnie, in the 21st century are no different. There are thousands of failed medical theories. For instance, being overweight and obese has nothing to do with eating too much or lack of exercise, simple deficiency of a certain class of nutrients. And then there are no genetically transmitted diseases. There are no autoimmune diseases unless you're born like a bubble boy kind of thing. And then you're looking at things like birth defects. There's no genetically transmitted birth defects. They're all caused by nutritional deficiencies of the embryo. Cholesterol and saturated fat don't cause cardiovascular disease. In fact, they're essential nutrients, and you get like dozens of different diseases when you're deficient in cholesterol and saturated fat, including low T, ED, menopause at age 30 instead of 60, 70, adrenal exhaustion, and Alzheimer's disease. Those are all cholesterol and saturated fat deficiency diseases. But the pharmaceutical industry is happy because they get to make Cialis and Viagra and statin drugs.
You say that there is a very important link between mineral deficiencies in the body and chronic degenerative disease. How did you become convinced that minerals played such an important role in preserving health?
Well, I was a pathologist, Bonnie, on a big project for the National Institutes of Health from the mid-60s to the mid-70s. I did 20,000 autopsies, some 17,000 some change of over 454 species of zoo animals, and 3,000 humans, 20 million chemistries, 20 million slides of special stains, looking for pollution as a contributor to or the cause of death from natural causes. And what I learned was that every birth defect, every death from natural cause has nothing to do with genetics or pollution. It's all just nutritional deficiencies of the embryo. And so in many cases, they're reversible even after the baby's born, like muscular dystrophy and cystic fibrosis. And they're certainly all preventable. And so it was very clear that these diseases were just simply caused by nutritional deficiencies, most of which were mineral deficiencies. For instance, sudden heart death, cardiomyopathy, heart disease. I've done 1,700 autopsies on kids under the age of 10 that died of that one. It's a deficiency of a single mineral. Congestive heart failure is due to a deficiency of a single vitamin. And then you look at arthritis is multiple mineral and vitamin deficiencies, regardless of age or gender. And then you have things like high blood pressure is due to mineral deficiencies. And so it was very clear that mineral deficiencies are the cause of most of our degenerative diseases.
You have said that the medical system has been a self-policing, protected monopoly since 1914, following the Flexner Report. What was the Flexner Report?
Well, Flexner was a retired college president, and the Rockefellers hired him, okay? And the Carnegies, together with the Rockefellers, hired him to study medical schools and see which ones would use pharmaceuticals opposed to herbs and natural things. And the Flexner Report came out in 1912, actually, and by 1914, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers had created a union for medical doctors who were going to use pharmaceuticals, which they were going to make. And the union was the American Medical Association. And so they're self-policing. There's no oversight by any agency. And you see this in the newspaper all the time. Doctor found guilty of misbilling Medicare, Medicaid of $375 million. Another doctor, this was from, Dr. Roy, if you would, from Dallas, Texas. And there was this doctor from Detroit, got 175 years in jail for doing hundreds of surgeries and people that didn't need them just to get the money and so on. And so these things go on all the time because there's no oversight by anybody. There's nobody checking diagnoses. There's nobody checking billing and so forth. And so when you look at them, for instance, just infections in hospitals. There's 2 million infections each year in hospitals, of which 90,000 die every year. Now, Bonnie, what would happen if Iran or North Korea were to send over an intercontinental ballistic missile with either a biological weapon or a nuclear weapon, and injure or infect 2 million people in a large population center in America and kill 90,000. It'd be war, wouldn't it? Well, here's one trade that does it every year in their workplace in the hospital. They don't even get an OSHA ticket because they're self-policing and there's no oversight by anybody. They literally get away with murder, and nobody seems to care as long as insurance is paying the bill. Well, I've been working very hard. I've had so many doctors call me. They thought they were speaking to me on a private phone, but they were on the radio live, and they threatened to murder me and all sorts. They named themselves, and the clinics they're working with say, don't come to our clinic unconscious because you won't leave alive and this sort of thing. I said, well, let me clarify what you're saying. You're saying you're going to murder me if I come in a helpless state. Of course, they say yes. And so there's hundreds of thousands of people who heard them say that.
How did being a practicing veterinarian affect your view of health care?
Well, first of all, Bonnie, we don't have health insurance. We have life insurance for expensive horses and things like that, but we don't have health insurance for any animals. And so we learn to maximize and sort of make dependable, predictable production of milk, for instance, by supplementing milk cows, dairy cows. Every cow will give a gallon and a half of milk instead of some giving a gallon and a half and some giving a quart and some giving a pint. We can predict that if you feed them this much and give them these supplements, they're all going to give a gallon and a half of milk. And the same thing is true with how many eggs chickens lay, how many pounds of meat they'll make every week as they grow. By giving these nutrients, we were able to eliminate every birth defect you can name, and 10 times that many you can't. We've tripled the lifespans of animals by supplementing them. And so when I did this big project with the National Institutes of Health, where I did my 20,000 autopsies and 20 million chemistries and 20 million science special saints looking for the pollution piece, it was very obvious that we were able to eliminate 900 different diseases and all birth defects that still plague people. And so I began to, as a physician, used these veterinary treatments on my human patients. My patients were very kind of giggly about that. They say, if you don't like what your doctors do, or you're not happy with the results or lack of results, go see Wallach. Now, he'll treat you like a dog, but you get better. And so we began doing this in 1978, and sure enough, we're getting the same results in people as we did in animals. And so it's very clear that we could, and it's their doctors who take them off the heart transplant list. It's their doctors who release them from nursing homes when they have Alzheimer's disease and terminal Parkinson's disease. It's their doctors who take them off of dialysis when we get them. Even if they haven't urinated in 10 years, we can get them off of dialysis. If they're getting six dialysis treatments a week because they haven't urinated in 10 years. And the quickest one was 2 weeks, but it normally takes a couple of months, but the quickest one was 2 weeks, got them urinating, and another month or so they're off of dialysis. But it's very easy. Type 2 diabetes, very simple nutritional deficiency. We've known it for 80 years. And so we can take somebody who's been a diabetic, type 2 diabetic, for 30 years, and in 30 days their doctors will say, I don't know why, but you're not a diabetic anymore.
Wow, that's incredible. You spent 2 years in Africa. What were you doing there?
Well, yes, I was going to go there indefinitely, forever. I was enjoying myself. Marlon Perkins, who I worked with as a kid in the last couple of years of grade school and all through junior high and high school and the first couple of years of agricultural college at University of Missouri, I worked with Marlon Perkins at the St. Louis Zoo. He's very famous for the Mutual Omaha's Wild Kingdom show. He was a biologist there. And I worked for him as a farm boy. I would do anything he asked me to do. The city boys wouldn't do the nasty stuff, so he always called on me and got to know me. And as a graduate student in pathology, because I graduated ag school, I was a graduate student taking veterinary courses, but I also was taking courses towards my PhD or the equivalent PhD in comparative pathology, where I do autopsies in animals and people. And so it was kind of very obvious that I was able to help people, treat people, and Perkins loved it. And when I graduated veterinary school, he sent me to Africa for an indefinite period to work on the White Rhino Conservation Project and also the African Elephant Conservation Project. And 2 years into it, I was prepared to stay in Africa forever. I was having the time of my life. As you can imagine, I caught 200 white rhino, hundreds of elephants. I sent the white rhino back here. So if you see a white rhino in a wild animal park or zoo, it's one that I caught, or our offsprings are the ones that I caught. And so he sent me, after 2 years, he sent me a letter saying, look, we've got this big project from NIH, a big grant, and we're going to be doing autopsies on zoo animals that live in the big cities. They're going to be the canary in the mine, the early warning signal for pollution that might be injuring the people that live in these cities. And because you're a comparative pathologist and you got your postdoctoral fellowship here in comparative pathology, we want you, and you wrote the first paper in a mass dial from pollution, we want you to be the pathologist on the project. So I came back and became the pathologist on the project. That's why they picked me. I was only 24 years old. They could have picked pathologists, I mean, with three PhDs from Harvard Medical School or something like that, but they picked me because I was the only one who'd done the first work on a mass dial in America from pollution, got it published. So that's why they picked me for that.
I'm speaking with veterinarian and naturopathic physician Dr. Joel Wallach. Today's show, a stick of butter a day keeps the doctor away. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. How can you determine that a person has a specific nutrient deficiency, and how is it that you can link a specific nutrient deficiency to a specific health condition?
Okay, well, first of all, that one project, I did 20,000 autopsies. I've done another 18,000 after that, and other projects, and so about 38,000 autopsies. And you have to appreciate that all the essential nutrients are recorded to be essential nutrients after research, $100 billion worth of research on these nutrients to see if they're required for certain functions in life, what diseases you get when you don't have them in the animal industry. And so all I had to do is do all the testing and samples of organs, cerebrospinal fluid, blood, tissue samples, and we could run and see what nutrients, what vitamins, what amino acids, what fatty acids, what minerals were in there, what fatty acids and so forth. And if they had a certain disease, we knew which ones to really look for. And we got all the clinical records of the people and the animals from the zoos. And so it's very easy to say, oh, well, this disease is caused in these five different species of vertebrates. For instance, type 2 diabetes. I was starting to find type 2 diabetes in crocodiles. Now, why would a crocodile have a genetic disease of humans, right? Maybe he ate a Baptist preacher in Africa that had diabetes, got the gene that way. Well, it's a silly thing, but that's what doctors were proposing. Well, it turns out that all vertebrates, regardless if they're a reptile or a bird or a mammal or a rat or a human, all vertebrates, if they have a nutritional deficiency, will get the same disease from the same nutritional deficiency.
So you can determine these nutritional deficiencies how? By analyzing organs chemically, for instance?
Yes. We analyze the organs chemically, the skin, the hair, blood, vitreous from the eye, cerebrospinal fluid. And again, there's normal levels known. And if they're severely low and they have this disease, and you look them up in the records of the animal research, well, by golly, when you're low in this particular mineral or this vitamin and you have this disease, that disease is caused by deficiency of that mineral, that vitamin.
I see. Are birth defects created by defective genes?
Well, no, that's one of the questions I ask. Of course, there's an enormous number of birth defects in zoo animals from the big zoos around the United States and Canada and Mexico, and that's because they were feeding them human food. They're feeding them human food, and they're getting all these birth defects just like humans. Cleft palate, heart defects of all kinds, muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis, cerebral palsy. It's kind of interesting to find cerebral palsy in a llama and type 1 diabetes in a flamingo and this sort of stuff. And, of course, we're getting sickle cell anemia in hummingbirds and deer. It's all because they're deficient in the same nutrients in the embryonic stage. And so, for instance, sickle cell anemia, in the third to seventh week of pregnancy, when the bone marrow is forming, the cells that manufacture the hemoglobin don't form correctly, and so they make dysfunctional hemoglobin. That's why the cells sickle. And it's kind of interesting. I find it in all these different animal species, including hummingbirds and deer and antelope. I also found it in not only black people, who is where it's supposed to be a genetic disease, but also in white people. So how do you get a black gene in a white guy, or maybe a white gene in a black guy? Well, it turns out it's the same disease. It's just they call it different names in different people. For instance, in white people, sickle cell anemia is called thalassemia.
So then these conditions in either ethnicities of people or animals are then all caused by nutritional deficiencies. That's what you're saying, right?
That is correct. Obviously, infectious diseases are a totally different story. Toxic problems are a totally different story. But when it comes to degenerative diseases, birth defects, they're all caused by nutritional deficiencies.
What is epigenetics?
I'm actually considered one of the founders or the father of epigenetics, the science of epigenetics. And epigenetics says that your genes require a variety of things to maximize their function. The medical system believes that genes are autonomous. You put a handful of genes into a bucket of saline solution or warm salt water, and they're going to do their thing. Well, that's not true. They require 60 essential minerals, 16 vitamins, 12 amino acids, 3 fatty acids to do their thing. And if you're missing any of these 90 essential nutrients, or if they're reduced in amounts significantly below the optimal amounts, you're going to get symptoms and or diseases. And so, again, even in the earliest of stages of pregnancy, when you have even Down syndrome, it's reversible. You give the mother the right nutrients. If she's been diagnosed by amniocentesis or by a ultrasound that the embryo has a Down syndrome situation, trisomy 21, and you give the 90 essential nutrients and change the mother's diet, and we've actually reversed Down syndrome before 3 months of pregnancy. Once the baby's born with Down syndrome, I can add 50 or more IQ points to them so that they can function and be independent and hold jobs and learn how to work computers, and they can get driver's licenses and do their own banking and things. And I've actually been the best man at some of the weddings of some of these kids with Down syndrome, when I would help the girl and the boy increase their IQs where they can function in a working situation. if they wanted to get married, and of course I was their best man.
So what you're saying then is that genes require nutrients for their full expression, is that it?
Well said. And then of course, because of the work that I did, came out with the first major book on epigenetics, and the subtitle I came up with based on all the research with genes that had failed and all the research using nutrients to solve problems that were thought to be genetic. The subtitle is my book, Epigenetics, is The Death of the Genetic Theory of Disease Transmission, Another Failed Medical Theory.
So you're saying that the whole theory of a genetic transmission of disease is not correct?
You are correct. It is not correct.
So then you've mentioned 90 essential nutrients. Would then taking all 90 essential nutrients maximize genetic potential?
Oh, absolutely. Because genes, DNA, RNA, and telomeres, little end caps in your chromosomes, require these nutrients to maximize their ability to perform. And this down at the biochemical level inside the cells, and I was the first guy to use electron microscopes back in the day for pathology and studying pathology, and at the subcellular chemical level. And most people at that time were using it for anatomy and that sort of thing, but I used it for pathology. And so it was very, very clear that these nutrient deficiencies were causing biochemical defects, which were then misinterpreted as genetic problems.
Is there such a thing as a genetic defect, even if a person is taking all 90 essential nutrients, do you think?
Well, it's possible for people to get a disease that is thought to be genetically transmitted, even if they're supplementing, because they can't absorb. That old adage, you are what you eat, is not true. You are what you absorb. And so you can take all the nutrients you want, but if you're not absorbing, you're still going to get those deficiency diseases.
Now, what would cause a person to not be able to absorb the nutrients?
Well, in the industrialized world, including Europe and the big cities in Asia and Africa and the big cities in South America and Mexico and so forth, the most common cause of malabsorption, inability to efficiently absorb nutrients of all kinds, is gluten intolerance. It actually causes a loss of the villi. They lose about 95% of the absorptive surface of the lining of the intestine. It's not an allergy to wheat. It's actually a intolerance, just like nobody's allergic to poison ivy, but everybody's intolerant of it. And so what you get is a contact enteritis when you have a gluten intolerance. You put poison ivy in your skin, you get a contact dermatitis. It's the same principle. Now, the nice thing about a gluten intolerance, you get on a gluten-free diet and take the 90 essential nutrients, your intestine will heal. The villi over time will grow back. If you're 60, 70, 80 years old, it might take a year and a half to grow them back. If you're under 10 years of age, it'll take you only a couple of months to grow back. And, of course, in kids, they'll see, even though it might take a couple of months to regrow the villi, they're going to see a dramatic, easily observed benefit from a gluten-free diet and the 90 essential nutrients in a couple of weeks, like getting rid of asthma they've had their whole life in 2 weeks' time is gone on a gluten-free diet and supplementing with the 90 essential nutrients. And in adult humans, you're looking at it might take a year and a half to go from a severely damaged small intestine from the gluten intolerance to normal, but you might see some really significant recognizable benefit of a gluten-free diet and the 90 essential nutrients in 6 to 8 weeks.
So that having been said, you put a lot of importance on gluten intolerance.
Oh, absolutely. When people have multiples of disease, and you see this all the time, where people have diabetes, they have arthritis, they have high blood pressure, they've got congestive heart failure, they've got low thyroid, they've got macular degeneration, they have back problems, ruptured disc, and peripheral neuropathies, and they may have kidney failure, and they're on dialysis. Man, these guys got terrible genes. They got 18 diseases here. They're seeing 6 specialists. They're on 21 prescription drugs. You get them on a gluten-free diet, get them on the 90 essential nutrients, and all of those diseases will go away because they're all nutritional deficiencies caused by malabsorption.
Is it possible to get all of your nutrition from food? And if not, why not?
It's absolutely impossible, Bonnie, to get your nutrition from food, and here's why. For thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years, the average poor guy, the slave, the subsistence farmer, would throw wood ashes into the gardens for fertilizer. And this happened all over the world. So somehow everybody around the world who was using wood for fuel, which is everybody, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago, up until just a couple hundred years ago, wood was the universal fuel. And they would throw the wood ashes in the gardens and would fertilize the plants to get more yield and stronger, healthier plants. The bugs wouldn't need them because they were healthier plants. Well, it turns out that wood ashes are not ashes. 95% to 98% of the wood ashes, that powder we'd call wood ashes, are really minerals that the trees sucked up out of the ground. You burn the wood, but the minerals inside the cells of the tree, the wood, would just drop out as powder in the bottom of the stove or the fireplace. And they might have a little gray color or black because there was some unburned carbon because he dampened down the fire at night, so he'd have coals to start the fire in the morning, save a couple of matches. And but nobody knew the plants were absorbing these minerals, and when they were eating the pumpkins and the tomatoes and the okra and the beets and the onions and the peas and beans and corn, that they were getting these minerals that the plants had soaked up from the ground because they were being fertilized with these plant minerals, a.k.a. wood ashes. People didn't know that then. They don't know it now. Even people who are environmentalists and professors of agriculture at the big universities don't know it. Okay, so you're learning something here that only God and you know right now, right? And that's why my book's in the Smithsonian Institute, because I was able to figure this out. And what happened was this went on for thousands of years until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Monday, September 4th, 1882. I know the exact moment and place, because it was in the newspapers. Every newspaper in the world had the story in it the very next day, because we had the telegraph. The story went out, and every newspaper printed the story. And basically, what happened was, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Monday, September 4th, 1882, on Pearl Street in New York City, on the bluff overlooking the construction of Brooklyn Bridge, Thomas Edison pulled the switch on the first commercial electric generating plant. And within 10 years, every town, city, municipality in the industrialized world converted from wood as the universal fuel to electricity. Here comes the ultimate question, Bonnie. When you fuel your home with electricity, how many wood ashes are left over to put in your gardens every morning? Zero, nada, zippo, none. And what did people replace that traditional source that they've been using for thousands of years to obtain their nutritional minerals from, the wood ashes? What did they replace that with? Nothing, because they didn't know they were getting any nutritional minerals. They didn't even know that concept back then. And so they didn't even know they were getting those nutritional minerals from the wood ashes being put into the gardens.
I'm speaking with veterinarian and naturopathic physician, Dr. Joel Wallach. Today's show, a stick of butter a day keeps the doctor away. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, the story gets worse here. Because politicians then, or as they are now, beat their chests like gorillas and say, hey, you vote for me, I want to get electricity in every home. And so they kept their word. And there was the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority. There was the Hoover Dam and the Colorado River. And every household had electricity. They had factories that were working 24/7. No worries about power. And there was an unintended consequence, which at first everybody thought was a great thing. And that was flood control. Well, not only did human beings and animals get their minerals from plant minerals, a.k.a. wood ashes, going into the gardens, but also for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, the most fertile, the most expensive farmlands were always bottomland, floodplains, river valleys, river bottoms, because every spring the rivers would flood. And when the floodwater would recede, it would leave silt behind, which is mud, minerals from plants and up in the mountains. And when the snow would melt, it would take these minerals and bring them downstream. And when the floodwaters would recede, the silt was left, and farmers would plow this into the field. Free, good fertilizer that valley had been getting for thousands of years before man came along. And so it's replenishing the minerals by plowing in that silt. Well, now we had flood control, which everybody thought was a great thing. So there's no more flooding. So we're not getting the silt from spring floods anymore. We're not getting the wood ashes anymore. And so our soils became extremely minerally deficient, because every time you grow a crop, the plants will suck up the minerals. Suck up the minerals, suck up the minerals. And after 4 or 5 years, there's no more minerals in the soil because the plants have been sucking them out, not any going back in. And what we get from that? Well, certainly our foods don't have the minerals in them anymore, and two-thirds of the 90 essential nutrients are minerals. But also, we got a very, very big problem here. All these degenerative diseases, but also we killed the ocean. Because what was the food that fed the ocean? The silt coming down the rivers that got through and didn't get in the floodplains, went all the way down to the deltas and out into the gulfs and the oceans and the seas. It's spelled S-E-A, right? Seas. And these nutrients, these minerals, then fed the little plankton and the algae, which fed the little fish, which then fed the medium-sized fish, which fed the big fish, which fed us. Well, now it's not worth a fishing group and their fleet to go out, try and catch fish and come back because they can't even make enough money from the fish they might catch because there's no fish out there anymore. There's no more food for them because the ocean is dead, not from pollution, because they've cut off the food supply by damming up the rivers for electricity.
Well, just as a quick follow-up to that, what do you think about Fukushima? Now, there's some pollution for you.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, it's kind of interesting. I live in San Diego, and you go down to the beach in San Diego Bay or on the Pacific Ocean, and guess what? Here's all these boats and things that float all the way from Japan, and so you know that there's radiation in the ocean. And so, fortunately, the ocean is a big place and it's able to, soak up and neutralize a certain amount of that radiation. But I would not be eating food from the southern part of Fukushima because that's where all the radiation took place.
With regard to the 90 essential nutrients, you've mentioned 60 minerals, 16 vitamins, 12 amino acids, and 3 fatty acids. How and when were the 90 essential nutrients identified? Is this something you did, or has this information been available for a long time?
Well, going back 300 years ago, Bonnie, people knew, fishermen knew, that if they ate cabbage every day, they could stay out in the ocean for a couple of months without coming home and not getting scurvy. They didn't know what it was in the cabbage that they were getting to prevent scurvy, but if they didn't do that, if they just ate salt pork or ate fish they were catching, they would get scurvy. And millions of sailors, particularly from England and Japan, died over a decade in the days of sail from just scurvy. And then, so they knew there's some concept there, and they learned about vitamin C. And then, of course, there was beriberi, which is another killer of sailors who stayed out for a long time. And it was actually found in the rice bran of brown rice. It was discovered if you ate white rice, you were going to get beriberi. And if you ate brown rice, you could cure it or prevent it. And same way with pellagra, another disease of sailors, which is, again, vitamin B3 niacin is found in the bran of rice. And not in vegetables and not in meat or anything like that, but certainly in the bran of rice. And pellagra, I have a lot of fun with medical doctors today, Bonnie. I'll ask them, have you ever seen any beriberi or pellagra or scurvy? Oh, no, that's only found in third world countries. We don't have that in America anymore. Well, half the people they see have those things. They come to me and say, well, my doctor's been treating me for 10 years. They can't figure out what's wrong. Well, I look at them, find out what they got, and most of them will have pellagra, they'll have scurvy, they'll have beriberi. In fact, for instance, an example would be congestive heart failure is caused by deficiency of a single vitamin. Okay? You take those vitamins, guess what? Congestive heart failure goes away in a week. And then there's actually a little kid they called me about on the radio the other week. And the little kid is like 5 years old, has cardiomyopathy heart disease. That's where I did 1,700 autopsies in China on kids under the age of 10, died of cardiomyopathy heart disease, a deficiency of a single mineral. And they want to do a heart transplant in this kid instead of just giving him the 90 essential nutrients, a little bit of extra of that mineral, because they're ignorant. They don't know. They don't spend any time learning about nutrition because they believe everything's genetic. Okay? So those are the sort of things. And it's been over time. Starting about back in the early 1800s, there was a guy by the name of Schuessler. He was a hospitalist, one of the first hospitalists, who was a physician who worked in hospitals. And he was very detail-oriented, and he would make a list of symptoms of the people who would come in. And if they were indigent, and nobody would collect their bodies, no families would come to collect the body and bury them, if they died in the hospital, he would cremate them, he'd burn them, and then analyze the ashes compared to people who were killed by accidents, and he'd cremate some of them, and he would analyze the ashes for their mineral content. He said, you know, everybody who has this particular disease is deficient in this mineral. His name was Schuessler. Schuessler's cell salts. He found 13 diseases that he could tag to a certain mineral deficiency, and he came up with these Schuessler's cell salts, and then he'd see people come in with those diseases, and he'd give them that cell salt with that mineral, and the disease would go away. And he was the first one to think in those terms. That was back in the early, about 1833.
Oh, that's interesting. Is there a difference between human food and animal food?
Well, not really. Human food and animal food has to have certain things, and all vertebrates have to have certain things in the food, right? We're talking about proteins and minerals, essential fats, vitamins, and these are brought into our bodies through consuming of food. Well, the same thing is true for all vertebrates, whether they're an animal or a human being. Okay, the same thing is true. And again, if you're deficient in a particular nutrient, any vertebrate will get the same disease, whether you're a crocodile or a hummingbird or a deer or a human being or a fish or a turtle or a flamingo. And this is what I learned in doing all those autopsies. That's why my book's in the Smithsonian Institute, because of those kind of findings. Nobody had known those things before I did all that work. It was really a real opportunity for me to learn that sort of stuff. And it's kind of interesting. If you go and check one of those books out that resulted from that 1,200-page book, if you check out one of those books from a medical school library or scientific department's library, you'll have to leave $1,800 as a deposit to make sure you're going to bring the book back. If they're new and they haven't been opened, they're still in the wrappers, they sell for $25,000 each, Monty, because it would take $1 billion to redo that study. And they gave me $25 million. I'm only a kid, you know, 24 years old. And so they gave me $25 million to do the study. It was a lot of money back then. And so it would take $1 billion to redo that study. And so that's why the libraries, medical libraries, are willing to pay $25,000 for each book.
One of the things I was getting at with that question, and I should have phrased it differently, is domesticated animals, they produce food to feed mm-hmm. them with, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Does that animal food that's commercially produced for animals, does that differ than what we're fed from the grocery store?
Oh, yeah. Well, our food, let's say you buy a head of cabbage from the grocery store, you buy carrots from the grocery store, you buy potatoes from the grocery store. Depending on where they were grown, they might have 3 minerals, they might have 12, they might have 18, they might have 25 or 30 or 40 or 50 or 60, but most of them will have less than 10, because plants only need 3 to give the farmer enough yield to justify planting that crop. All vertebrates, including humans, require 60 minerals. Now, in animals, we make sure they get all 60 minerals. We supplement them with that because we don't have health insurance for them. Okay, in humans, we have health insurance, and nobody seems to care. Say, well, why would I spend $3 a day for all those nutrients and give up my cup of exotic coffee when I can just eat well? My doctor says I can just eat well and get everything I need. Well, the doctor just gets a lot of patients because he's using them as an ATM machine by telling them, don't supplement. You're wasting your money.
What about diet? What food should we be eating and what should we be avoiding?
Well, one of the most valuable foods is eggs. What you think about it, Bonnie? You ever seen that little white spot on the top of a yolk of an egg?
Yes.
About the size of a zero on a printed page. That is the fertilized embryo. Okay, that's an embryo. And at the end exactly of 21 days of incubation, that chick has consumed all the yolk and all the white of the egg and pecks out a hole to get out of there because he's looking for food. He's hungry. He's eating everything. But that little chick has a beating heart, lungs, a liver that works, kidneys that work, a brain that works, eyes that work, digestive system, and skin and feathers and joints with cartilage and ligaments and tendons, connective tissue and muscles. all from, remember, genes can't do it without the raw materials. And so the food in that egg was perfect enough to create and allow the genes to express themselves and produce all of those different tissues. Now, if you just put water in the egg, say take that little embryo off, that yolk, throw the yolk and the white of the egg away, and then take an egg, puncture a little hole, dump all that with a suction, suck out the yolk and the white of the egg, and just fill it with saline solution and put that little embryo back in there. In 21 days, open that egg up, and Petri just take a look at it in the microscope, and all you'll have is that same little embryo, which is now starved to death, right? It hasn't grown by one cell, because it can't without all the nutrition that was in that egg. And so any doctor who tells you not to eat eggs should be put in jail, because it provides nutrients to us we can't get from any other food. And by giving up eggs, by demonizing the cholesterol in eggs and the saturated fat in eggs and cream and butter and red meat and so forth, doctors created an enormous number of diseases because these are essential nutrients. Okay, a cholesterol deficiency results in Alzheimer's disease. It's not, Alzheimer's disease is not caused by aluminum. It's one of the stupidest theories that doctors ever came up with.
I'm speaking with veterinarian and naturopathic physician, Dr. Joel Wallach. Today's show, a stick of butter a day keeps the doctor away. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, I was just about to ask you about cholesterol. Now, I've heard you say that lard, butter, and cream are good for you, and that oils, perhaps including olive oil, aren't. Is that right?
You got that exactly right, Bonnie. Oils oxidize and turn into trans fats, heterocyclic amines, and acrylamides. And because of that, we have begun to kill ourselves, okay? Americans are dying younger and younger and younger. Our children will be the first generation of Americans that do not live as long as their parents. Because when grandma babysits the kids on the weekend, and parents are out on the beach sunning or doing whatever they're going to do, grandmas give microwave popcorn, for instance, to these kids to entertain while they're watching TV or as a reward for raking the lawn or something. Well, when you microwave the popcorn, the margarine that's in there that heats up and pops the corn turns into trans fats, heterocyclic amines, and acrylamides. And 50,000 kids under the age of 10 every year get heart attacks as a result of consuming microwave popcorn, and 20,000 of those 50,000 die. So grandmas are killing their grandkids, and parents are killing their kids by giving them microwave popcorn and theater popcorn and salad dressings and cooking oils and mayonnaise, because all those things oxidize and turn into trans fats, heterocyclic amines, and acrylamides.
Now, so then you're implying that lard, cream, and butter don't oxidize and turn into trans fats? Is that what you're saying?
That is correct, because they're not oils. They don't have double bonds. They don't have incomplete bonds. They're all saturated fats. They're quite safe. You could put a stick of butter out for a week. It might get soft and melt, but it doesn't oxidize. You cut an apple in half, and in a half hour, with the cut surface exposed to the air, it turns brown. Well, what is it turning brown? That apple is oxidizing. It's kind of like steel railroad tracks rusting. It just happens in 10, 15, 20 minutes on a cut surface of an apple. What is it in the apple that's oxidizing? It's the oil in the apple. Most people don't know there's oil in an apple. But the hard skin keeps oxygen from contacting it. And once you cut that skin off and you expose the white flesh to the air, the oxygen, it oxidizes in just a few moments. So here you go to a restaurant and they've got oil and vinegar, a little kind of a tray thing on the table, and they're nice white and red checkered tablecloths, and everybody's in there killing themselves by making their salad dressings with the oil, whether it's olive oil or canola oil, whatever it is. They're killing themselves by using oil and vinegar for salad dressings, or vinaigrette for salad dressings, or cooking oils.
Now, if you have a salad, do you dress it with anything?
Yes. You can use, for instance, the vinegar that's made from grapes, okay? There's no oil in grapes, okay? And so you can actually do that. But if you use the vinegar made from wheat, you get a gluten-containing vinegar, okay? So the balsamic vinegar that comes from grapes is okay, is safe, but white vinegar that's in mustard and ketchups and on the table with the salad dressing isn't. And, of course, chicken salad sandwiches, egg salad sandwiches, tuna salad sandwiches, the mayonnaise they use in there has oil in it. and it oxidizes and turns into trans fats, heterocyclamines, and acrylamides. Damages will kill you.
What about apple cider vinegar?
Apple cider vinegar is okay if it's truly apple cider vinegar instead of flavored white vinegar, which is then made from wheat. You have to read labels and ask questions when you go out to eat. Don't let the cook kill you.
You travel a lot. For instance, when I asked you where you lived, you told me you lived on Delta Airlines. So how do you maintain a healthy diet with your lifestyle?
Well, it's a very good question. And what I've learned to do, Bonnie, is to be highly selective on what I eat. It doesn't matter where I eat. I can eat McDonald's, and I get poached eggs for breakfast any time of the day because now they're serving breakfast 24/7. So I can get what they call round eggs at McDonald's, which is a poached egg and butter. I'll have four of those for breakfast any time of the day. And then I can get lettuce-wrapped burgers with no mayonnaise or no sauces on it, but I want lettuce and tomatoes and onions and the lettuce wrap on it, so I'm not getting anything with vinegar or mayonnaise that has oxidized oil in them. I'm not getting the bun with any gluten in it. And I can have a little glass of red wine at a steakhouse, get a nice steak. And I like baked sweet potatoes with butter. I can have that for breakfast, or I can have baked sweet potatoes with butter for dinner. I like salad bars at these big restaurants. So I can get the beets. I like beets, and I also like steamed carrots and things like that. I don't like medleys of things, you know, like you got six or eight different beans and things in there, because they use wheat to actually thicken the sauce. They use wheat to hold together meatloaf and meatballs. They use wheat to thicken gravies and soups. And so you have to ask a lot of questions.
Now, you've brought this up before, but there was a television show called Wild Kingdom on television. I was surprised to be reminded about that. I haven't thought about that show since I was a kid. And you worked for the host of that show when you were a kid.
That's correct, Marlon Perkins. I said earlier that this was a wonderful, wonderful man, Marlon Perkins, who's a biologist, worked at the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago, and then he moved on to the St. Louis Zoo, where I met him. And he was a great biologist, and he recognized the value of that study that I did and found the first mass die-off from pollution. Since he was one of my non-relative male mentors, I gave him a copy of that article, and he was the one who sent me to Africa to work on the White Rhino Conservation Project and the African Elephant Conservation Project. And when he got that grant to study pollution as a cause of disease in zoo animals in the big cities, and also, you know, the concept of the canary in the mine. So they're going to use these different species of animals that might be sensitive to pollution and give us some kind of clue before we died what to do about different pollutants. And so he wanted me to be the pathologist on the project. So Wild Kingdom has a very special place in my heart. And I was his veterinarian for many years.
And I just wanted to reiterate that you are the author of an important 1,200-page book entitled Diseases of Exotic Animals that is now in the Smithsonian Museum. And how did you come to write this book, and what's it about?
Well, that was part of these studies I did with these 20,000 autopsies in these zoos in the big cities around the United States to looking for pollution. But I'm finding all these diseases that were not genetic, were not from pollution, but were just simple nutritional deficiencies, because all the animals in the zoo were being fed the very best human food. And they're getting all the deficiencies. And so I saw every deficiency, every disease you can think of. And I got all the clinical records from each of the animals in the zoo, because they were captives. So there was clinical records if they were ever treated for something, what they were being fed. And the same thing with the people I was doing autopsies on as a comparative pathologist. And getting my postdoctoral fellowship, which is kind of the equivalent of a PhD degree. And it was very, very easy to determine that these diseases were not caused by pollution or genetics, but just simple nutritional deficiency diseases. It was quite the project, and that's why it's in the Smithsonian Institute as a national treasure.
Could we talk about a few unhealthy conditions? And I wanted to get your comments on it. What about cancer?
Well, you know, cancer, Bonnie, is a self-inflicted disease. It's not genetic in any way, shape, or form. There's certain pollutants like radiation can certainly increase your risk of certain cancers. Smoking can certainly increase your risk of cancers. Eating processed meats, deli slices, sandwich meats, pastrami, pepperoni, Spam, those things can increase your risk of cancer. Cooking your meat well done where the fat is burnt increased his risk of breast cancer by 462%. And this was a big study, the Harvard Nurses Health Study, 90,000 nurses over 20 years, and this was part of that study that eating meat cooked well done or burnt increases your risk of breast cancer by 462%. I mean, that's horrible. When doctors say, eat your meat cooked well done, Lucy, because we got to watch out for salmonella and E. coli. Well, I'd rather deal with salmonella and E. coli, get the runs. And so it's, you know, easy to deal with that as opposed to getting cancer.
Well, obviously, you're probably not in big favor of a barbecue, but let's say you want to cook yourself a hamburger. How do you do it?
Well, I love barbecue. And being from Missouri, we barbecue, right? And growing up at a little beef farm, we ate a lot of meat in the barbecue. What we would do is take a stainless steel cookie sheet, put it on the grill, cover it deeply with a coarse kosher salt, big coarse kosher salt crystals, and put the hamburgers on top of that and then close the top. And they got smoky taste and everything. And we could cook them medium rare without the outside being burnt and so forth. And that's how we ate them in our steaks and chicken and fish and everything. So we never had to worry about the flames hitting the meat and burning it.
So what is it that prevents the charred? Is it the salt or the stainless steel plate?
The stainless steel plate, because, well, if you didn't put the salt on there to draw some of the fluids out of the meat or the fish or the chicken or so forth, it would stick to the pan. And so that was just sort of you're getting a twofer there. You're getting the salt flavor, plus you're getting easily cooked food that is not stuck to the stainless steel pan. And it's one of those things where you're going to be much, much healthier to use the salt because it's the raw material to make stomach acid. There is no such thing as acid reflux. It really should be called lack of acid reflux. Your stomach acid keeps your stomach environment sterile, so you don't get any yeast or bacteria growing in there, because it's the yeast and bacteria that ferment carbohydrates that turn into gas is what causes reflux. So it's a lack of acid reflux, not acid reflux.
Now, what about obesity? I was quite surprised to hear you say that obesity could possibly be due to a nutritional defect.
Yeah, it's due to a nutritional deficiency. Being overweight or obese has nothing to do with eating too much or lack of exercise. In fact, we get people to lose anywhere from a half a pound to 2 pounds a day in our program. We've been doing it, gosh, for 38 years, since 1978. And it's a very easy disease complex to prevent and reduce and eliminate just by supplementing with all 90 essential nutrients. We have some accelerators, which you can use to lose a half pound to 2 pounds a day, but you have to be able to absorb all this stuff. So you have to get gluten-free, and usually people who are overweight and obese or gluten intolerant, they can't absorb the nutrients, and so they gain the weight because they can't absorb the nutrients, even if they're supplementing with them. So you got to get them gluten-free. And even just being gluten-free, they'll lose 10, 15, 20 pounds in a couple of weeks. And then you throw in the 90 cents of nutrients with a little accelerator, and I get people lose 140 pounds in 100 days. They'll lose 60 pounds in 30 days. They'll lose 350 pounds in 7 months, and they'll never gain the weight back as long as they stay on the 90 cents of nutrients.
What do you mean by an accelerator?
Well, the accelerator is it's a amino acid mix that we put into a liquid, and they put a dropper full under their tongue. It absorbs through their oral tissues. And it actually is the raw materials for your adrenal glands, your pituitary, to make hormones. And as a result, instead of losing a half a pound every couple of days, you'll lose a half pound a day.
What about allergies? Are they affected by nutrients?
Well, food allergies, which are very common, are caused by lack of stomach acid, because your pepsin enzyme won't work in a neutral or an alkaline environment. So even if you just get your, you know, pH 1 is the most acid, 14 is the most alkaline, 7 is neutral, your stomach environment should be like 1.2. I mean, it's got to be like car battery acid to for everything to work properly and to stay sterile. Not fertility-wise, but to stay sterile in your stomach so you don't get reflux. And basically, salt is the raw material for your stomach to make stomach acid, hydrochloric acid. And then your pepsin will work to digest proteins down to amino acids. Nobody gets an allergy to amino acids, but they get allergies to partially digested proteins, which we call polypeptides. And so it's not having enough stomach acid, the enzymes won't work. And so if you salt your food heavily, the odds of you getting an allergy to foods is almost zero.
And what about Alzheimer's?
Well, again, Alzheimer's disease is a deficiency of a certain nutrient, which doctors have demonized so that Procter & Gamble could sell Crisco. And the ingredients in the products they were demonizing was cholesterol and saturated fat. So that's why they demonized things like cream and butter and eggs and lard, which were common for grandma. And grandma didn't want to give that stuff up. We've been using this for 20 generations. Why would I give it up? And so Procter & Gamble had to demonize those things. And they found, oh, there's a universal connection here. They all have cholesterol and saturated fat in them. Let's just demonize cholesterol and saturated fat. And they did so they could sell Crisco.
Dr. Joel Wallach, thank you very much.
Well, Bonnie, thank you so much for letting me share with your listening audience. You're a great lady. Thank you for helping save America. And look forward to working together with you many times in the future.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Joel Wallach. Today's show has been A Stick of Butter a Day Keeps the Doctor Away. Dr. Wallach is a veterinarian, naturopathic physician, and holds a postdoctorate fellowship in comparative pathology, as well as being an author and lecturer. He is the author of many books, including Dead Doctors Don't Lie, Epigenetics, The Death of the Genetic Theory of Disease Transmission, Black Gene Lies, and Rhino Express, The Saving of the White Rhino. He played a major role in the development of the market of liquid vitamin mineral supplements. For more information about Dr. Wallach and his nutrition program, call 1-888-311-4311 and Marge can help you. That's 1-888-311-4311. Visit www.90help.my90forlife.com. That's the numbers 90help.my90forlife.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, in a new talk, Amy Goodman speaks about media corruption, the power of ordinary people, and a good year for grassroots democracy. I hope you'll stay tuned. Journalist Amy Goodman was a founder and is longtime host of Democracy Now! That's a daily, hour-long, non-commercial radio and TV news broadcast you're probably acquainted with. That show is far from perfect, but it is quite a nice change from the corporatist-biased news programs that dominate the airwaves. Goodman has a new book out. It's a retrospective titled Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movement's Changing America. Amy recently spoke in Cambridge, Massachusetts on her book tour. Stan Robinson of Truth and Justice Radio snagged a recording of the entire 75-minute speech. And today, I'll play selections from that. Here, Amy talks on two familiar themes. First, ordinary people who made a difference. Second, the corruption of the corporate media and the need for independent media. Let's get back to the ordinary people who made a difference. Sometimes they acted individually, like Mohamed Bouazizi, whose suicide in Tunisia touched off the so-called Arab Spring. Or like Anjali Appadurai, who shamed the delegates to a UN climate conference with a brilliant speech. Sometimes, though, the ordinary people made the difference by acting collectively, such as Occupy Wall Street and the massive international protests against the execution of Troy Davis. The stories Goodman tells in today's segment have another thing in common, too. They all took place in a single year, 2011. Well, December 2010 for Mohamed Bouazizi, but let us not quibble. 2011 was a great year for popular rebellion against the status quo. It's high time to do it again, in mine humble opinion. We are well overdue. Here is Amy Goodman.
Now, I want to talk about one year. One year of movements, because movements matter. And I want to talk about 2011. Well, I'll start back in 2010 in December, and that was when a young man named Mohamed Bouazizi in Tunisia, right, comes out of the university. His country run by a corrupt dictator. He has no opportunity, goes into the marketplace to sell fruits and vegetables. The authorities steal his scale. He can't take it anymore, and he sets himself on fire. That's the spark of the Tunisian revolution. Well, WikiLeaks also played a role. I mean, it's not like the people of Tunisia didn't know they had a corrupt dictator, but they saw that the U.S. government knew it as well, but still shored him up to the tune of millions of dollars. They threw out their leader. And that sparked the Egyptian revolution, and you know what happened there. A million people in Tahrir and rose up all over the country. They threw out Mubarak. The turn that revolution has taken is frightening and dangerous, with so many of the people, and particularly young people, now imprisoned. It is an unfinished revolution. But I think the Arab Spring then inspired the Wisconsin uprising in the winter of 2011. Now, I mean, I think Governor Scott Walker had something to do with it as well, right? He said he was going to bust the public unions. Well, the teachers and the nurses, he assured the firefighters and the police that he wouldn't go after them. The problem was that the police and the firefighters were married to the teachers and the nurses. So they all occupied the state capitol in Madison. Of course, Democracy Now! Raced in. And I saw some of the biggest guys I've ever seen in my life, the Oshkosh prison guards. And I said to them, well, who did you vote for? And they said, Governor Walker. And I said, so what are you doing here? And they said, protesting Governor Walker, and outside 150,000 people marching in the freezing cold. Older gentleman, white hair, glasses, and he has a homemade placard that says IRS auditors against Walker. So this vista of protest, right? And I mean, Wisconsin's a very interesting state. It is the home of the John Birch Society, which is the racist, segregationist, anti-civil rights, anti-Dr. King organization that was co-founded by Fred Koch, the father of the oil barons Charles and David Koch. But it's also home to AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, founded in Wisconsin in 1932. And as I looked across the Capitol grounds, I saw the State Labor History Museum. And I thought about labor history in ways we don't usually think about. Like, go back to April 4th, 1968. That was the day in Memphis, Tennessee, that Dr. King was assassinated. What was he doing in Memphis? He was simply standing with sanitation workers who were trying to form a local of AFSCME. And then go back a year to the day before, April 4th, 1967. When Dr. King gave that speech at Riverside Church that thousands packed in to hear, when he spoke out against the war in Vietnam, even his inner circle said, Martin, don't do this. You've got the most powerful person on earth, the President of the United States, wrapped around your finger, you know, Lyndon Johnson. They said, you got him to sign the Voting Rights Act. You got him to sign the Civil Rights Act. This isn't your war. And Dr. King disagreed. He said the war at home links to the war abroad, and he wanted to take on the three issues he felt were critical: materialism, militarism, and racism. And he spoke. And he said his country, the country he loved, the United States, was the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. The corporate press excoriated him. They slammed him. I have the Life magazine issue. I mean, Time magazine, the Washington Post. They said his speech sounded like a script out of Radio Hanoi, that he had done a disservice to his cause, his country, and his people. And he just doubled down, spoke more often, spoke more loudly, until he was killed. And then let's go forward in 2011 to the summer, to the protests around the White House, the ring around the Rose Garden, thousands of people protesting the Keystone XL, the pipeline that would bring the dirty tar sands from Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico. 1,200 people got arrested, among them Naomi Klein. It was her first arrest. You know, I recommend every book she has written. This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate. The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, No Logo, Taking Aim at Brand Bullies. Oh, Bill McKibben was also arrested, right, who is the co-founder of 350.org and so many others. And then move forward 3 weeks to September 17, 2011, thousands stream into Zuccotti Park and occupy Wall Street, right? Thousands of people in the media metropolis in the world, and the media hardly covered them, like for the first week. I mean, the media moguls are driving by in their limousines, the elite press is there, but they're not covering them. But then it got absolutely ridiculous. They had to cover them. And so I remember Erin Burnett of CNN was just starting her show Out Front, and her first piece on Occupy was called Seriously? And this is how the mainstream media mainly did it. By the way, I don't really think the media is mainstream, because I really do think that those who care about war and peace, those who care about inequality, those who care about climate change, the fate of the planet, are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we have to take it back. You know, the media started to make fun of them and said, what do these people, they can't even make up their mind why they're there. They represent every different issue. They're like against the death penalty, they're against war, they're against inequality, they're against racism. And I thought, wow, they're listening. Yes, that is true. That's what their concerns are. But they saw that as their weakness. I saw that as their strength. You know, Dr. King talked about the seamless web. of all of these issues interconnected. Oh, they also said, you know, they can't even decide on a spokesperson. Well, it's a leaderful movement, not a leaderless movement. So ultimately, the police eviscerated the encampments, right, in New York, in Oakland, all over the country. And I went to many of these encampments in Louisville, Kentucky, everywhere. But for those who say, well, that movement didn't amount to a hill of beans, I really beg to differ. I mean, I think Occupy the language. The word Occupy, I think, was the most looked up word or the most used word in 2011, according to one of the major dictionaries. You say the word 1% and 99%, and absolutely everyone knows what you mean, right? You change the language, you change the world. And among the signs that people carried into Zuccotti Park were some that said, I am Troy Davis, and too much doubt. How many of you know who Troy Davis was? So I'm going to tell this story as we tell it in the book Democracy Now! And as we told it on Democracy Now!, the news hour. 4 days after people streamed into Zuccotti Park, on September 21st, 2011, Troy Anthony Davis was scheduled to die. We were reporting live from the grounds outside Georgia's death row in the town of Jackson, awaiting news about whether the U.S. Supreme Court would spare his life. I Am Troy Davis had become the rallying cry of a growing international movement to stop his execution. The effort had grown and now included not just the traditional anti-death penalty activists, but also prosecutors, prison wardens, exonerated death row prisoners, a former U.S. president, and the Pope. This is a story of a struggle against death that refuses to die. Troy Anthony Davis grew up in a middle-class neighborhood in Savannah, Georgia, with his three sisters and his brother. His mom worked at the local hospital. His dad, a Korean War vet, was a carpenter. On the night of August 18, 1989, 18-year-old Troy, who's African-American, went to Charlie Brown's pool hall with a friend. In the parking lot outside, Red Coles, a neighborhood tough, was arguing loudly with a homeless man named Larry Young. Several witnesses testified later Coles pistol-whipped Young. Pool hall patrons came outside and joined other bystanders to see what was going on. Troy Davis tried to intervene in the fight, but fled when Coles threatened him with a gun. At 1:15 in the morning, Mark McPhail, a white off-duty Savannah police officer who was working as a security guard at a Greyhound bus station next door, came outside to break up the fight. Gunshots pierced the summer night. Moments later, McPhail lay dying with a bullet wound to the head and another to the heart. He never drew his gun. Mark McPhail was a hero cop. The question was, who killed him? Red Coles immediately raced to the police station with his lawyer and pointed the finger at Troy Davis. So the next day, Troy Davis's face was plastered over every newscast. His family was desperate to reach him. He was in Atlanta with his cousin looking for a job. His sister, Martina, finally got in touch with him. Now, Martina is a heroine. I have interviewed her many times. Martina was a Persian Gulf Army nurse. She came back to this country when she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And then she fought for other women's lives. Her face adorned all the Savannah mammogram vans to encourage black women and poor women to get mammograms. She was honored as a leading light with Nancy Pelosi in Washington. So she's fighting for her own life, for other women's lives, and now she has to fight for her brother's life. She brings him back from Atlanta. And Troy Davis then turns himself in to the Chatham County Sheriff's Office. The teenager thought it was a case of mistaken identity, that he would simply clear up the confusion. Instead, Troy Anthony Davis was charged with murder. He was held in jail for 2 years before finally being tried August 1991. A jury deliberated for 2 hours and returned a guilty verdict. On August 30th, 91, Troy Davis, age 20, was sentenced to die. Davis would spend the next 20 years on death row. During that time, 7 of the 9 non-police witnesses recanted or changed their testimony, with some of them alleging police intimidation for their original false statements. One who did not recant his testimony was the man whom many have named as the actual killer, Red Coles. No physical evidence linked Davis to the shooting. which brings us to September 21st, 2011. There had been three other death warrants issued against Troy Davis that were each one vacated. We didn't know what would happen, but we knew we wanted to be there to broadcast what took place that night. If we could have been in the execution chamber, we would have. I deeply believe in showing the images. Most people don't realize in the United States how alone we are in the industrialized world in carrying out the death penalty and engaging in state killing. So this was going to be a major undertaking. On the prison grounds, the prison guards had sectioned off a protest pen for 150 protesters. There were Martina Correa in the middle of this pen with family members. Martina was now in a wheelchair. She would die weeks later of breast cancer. The heads of Amnesty International and NAACP were there. Oh, leaders from around the world. There were protests in Iceland and Germany and France and England and Japan all over. And then 1,000 people were outside the grounds who couldn't come onto the grounds. You know, the students from Morehouse, Dr. King's alma mater, and Spelman holding candles. And people had just streamed in. Now, in order to cover this, we couldn't just go into a studio. So we did what the big boys did. We rented a satellite truck. And, you know, this truck came in from Atlanta. All the satellite trucks were lined up on the corner. At first, I couldn't understand why on the periphery. But the guards had said they couldn't go near the protest pen. And they weren't even protesting. I mean, the journalists weren't saying why. And, I mean, maybe it didn't matter. They're going to, what, report for 20 seconds, 30 seconds? But we weren't there to just hear our own voices. If we were going to be broadcasting for hours, we were there to go to where the silence is. And often it's not so quiet there. It's just that it doesn't hit the corporate media microphones and cameras. So the satellite truck, I was annoyed, was late. I mean, these are the trucks that are rented by Fox and CNN. And when they came up on the grounds, they rolled down their window and they said, "Where do you want the truck, man?" And I said, "Well, I mean, the guards are saying that we have to put it over on the periphery there." They said, "Where do you want the truck, man?" I said, "Oh, I'm starting to warm up to these guys." Well, I was thinking right over here by the protest pen, and they barreled this truck over to the protest pen. And then they got out. And these guys were bigger than the Oshkosh prison guards. They have these huge cameras, and the guards that came running over to move the van, they backed off. And the cameraman handed me a microphone and said, "Where do you want to stand?" I said, against the rope, because I would like to reach in and speak to different people with my microphone. And they formed a kind of protective semicircle around me, and they said, "Start the show." And so we did. Now, we had with us the press packet that was given to us by the Department of Corrections. It was pretty thin. It first talked about Troy's schedule that day, right? He could see family and friends until 3, and then they had to clear out for a routine physical. A routine physical? The state was going to execute him in 4 hours. But you know what had happened before that in Texas? Death row prisoner had attempted suicide. They raced him to the hospital, they got him better, and then they executed him. So then another page talked about what Troy Davis would have for dinner. He had already turned down the special meal where you can order anything you want, like ice cream sundaes and steak or whatever you want, and he had said no to that. So the press packet described what Troy Davis would be offered. It said, the standard fare he would be offered, quote, grilled cheeseburgers, oven brown potatoes, baked beans, coleslaw cookies, and a grape beverage. The next page was just 4 lines, and it said, it listed the lethal cocktail that would follow. Pentobarbital, pancuronium bromide, potassium chloride, and Ativan, a sedative. The pentobarbital anesthetizes, the pancuronium bromide paralyzes, the potassium chloride stops the heart. Davis refused the sedative and the Last Supper. By 7 p.m., the U.S. Supreme Court was reportedly reviewing Davis's plea for a stay. The case was referred to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who hails from Pinpoint, Georgia, a community founded by freed slaves that's near Savannah, where Davis lived. The Supreme Court denied the plea. Davis's execution began at 10:53 p.m. A prison spokesperson delivered the news to the reporters outside. Time of death, 11:08 p.m. The eyewitnesses to the execution stepped out. According to an Associated Press reporter who was there, these were Troy Davis's final words. He said, "I'd like to address the McPhail family. Let you know I'm not the one who killed your son, your father, your brother. I'm innocent. The incident that happened that night was not my fault. I did not have a gun. All I can ask is that you look deeper into this case so that you really can finally see the truth." He said, "I asked my family and friends to continue to fight the fight." And then he looked at his executioners and said, "For those about to take my life, God have mercy on your souls, and may God bless your souls." The state of Georgia took Davis's body to Atlanta for an autopsy, charging the family for the transportation. On Troy Davis's death certificate, the cause of death is listed simply as homicide. As we stood on the grounds of the prison just after Troy Davis was executed, the Georgia Department of Corrections threatened to pull the plug on our broadcast. The show was over. I was reminded of what Mahatma Gandhi reportedly answered when asked what he thought of Western civilization. He said, "I think it would be a good idea." Now I want to go to the end of 2011, to December. If you're regular viewers and listeners or readers of Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, you know that we attend every UN climate summit. Given what happens inside, you might ask, why waste the fuel? It's not so much what happens inside, it's what happens outside. It's the thousands of people who come desperately from every corner of the planet to appeal to the historically biggest greenhouse gas emitter on the planet, which is the United States. And they say, like the 15-year-old boy from the Maldives said, "My country will be submerged with the rising waters." Or the people of sub-Saharan Africa who talk about the desertification of a continent, the cooking of a continent. Now, it's not as if we don't suffer from climate change ourselves in extreme ways, right? You have the extreme cold of the Northeast, and you've got the fires in the Northwest, and in California, the Dust Bowl conditions of the Midwest. But these seem so disparate, people don't have any way of connecting them. And it's up to the meteorologists. And the meteorologists should lose their, whatever it is they have, their licenses, if they don't on television and radio connect the words they flash constantly on television, extreme weather and severe weather, with the words climate change and global warming. It's not just about, you know, tuning into the weather to figure out what to wear. It's what we can do about it. You know, in the rest of the world, they have debates about climate change. It's what is the best strategy to deal with it. In this country, our debates revolve around whether human beings are in any way affecting or exacerbating climate change. The science is settled. It's as if every time we talked about planet Earth, we brought on someone from the Flat Earth Society for balance. And it matters because we're talking about the fate of the planet. So in 2011, the year that the UN Climate Summit took place in Durban, South Africa, they did something different. They invited the people from the outside in. They invited the youth to address the world body. And the person that the young people chose to speak for them was Anjali Appadurai. She was a student at College of the Atlantic, will be speaking there this weekend in Bar Harbor, Maine, where you get a degree in human ecology. She ascended the podium, and this is a part of what Anjali said. She said, "I speak for more than half the world's population. We are the silent majority. You've given us a seat in this hall, but our interests are not on the table. What does it take to get a stake in this game? Lobbyists, corporate influence, money? You've been negotiating all of my life. You've failed to meet pledges, you've missed targets, you've broken promises, but you've heard this all before. We're in Africa, home to communities on the front line of climate change. The science tells us we have 5 years max. You're saying, give us 10. The starkest betrayal of your generation's responsibility to ours is that you call this ambition. She said, where is the courage in these rooms? Now is not the time for incremental action. In the long run, these will be seen as the defining moments of an era in which narrow self-interest prevailed over science, reason, and common compassion. She said, there is real ambition in this room, but it's been dismissed as radical, deemed not politically possible. Stand with Africa. Long-term thinking is not radical. What's radical is to completely alter the planet's climate, to betray the future of my generation, and to condemn millions to death by climate change. What's radical is to write off the fact that change is within our reach. 2011 was the year in which the silent majority found their voice, the year when the bottom shook the top. 2011 was the year when the radical became reality. And then she quoted Nelson Mandela, who said, it always seems impossible until it's done. She said, so distinguished delegates and governments around the world, governments of the developed world, deep cuts now, get it done. And it was Democracy Now! That was there to broadcast this speech, that was there to hear the voices and play the voices of those who'd come from all over the world to talk about saving this planet. David and I wrote several books. The first is called The Exception to the Rulers. It should be the motto of all the media, to be the exception to the rulers, not just Democracy Now! And our second book was called Static. And the reason we called it that is in this high-tech digital age with high-definition television and digital radio, still all we get is static. That veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality, when what we need the media to give us is the dictionary definition of static. Criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history.
Amy Goodman, speaking in Cambridge, May 10, 2016. Next week, some more selections from Goodman's interesting talk. Thanks again to Stan Robinson for the original recording, which I have condensed. Stan is at truthandjusticeradio.org, and we are at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. There you'll find links to nearly 8 years of our shows, preserved for all eternity on MP3 audio files. Well, preserved for a while, anyway. From our East of the River satellite studio and Skunk Works, somewhere in darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimate non carborundum. Please come back again next week, and remember, let's try to live each day as though the truth were true. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call. true. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today on the show, I'm joined by longtime 9/11 truth activist Barbara Honegger to talk about her run for Congress on a 9/11 truth platform in the 20th District in California. Barbara Honegger, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you're considered one of the leaders of the 9/11 truth movement, particularly with your work on the Pentagon. You created the film Behind the Smoke Curtain, which is a really excellent film on the Pentagon. You did the virtual walking tour of the 9/11 Museum in New York City. And you've spoken around the country at conferences and probably around the world on conferences dedicated to 9/11. And then I think it was in the 1980s, you wrote the book October Surprise. And we'll hopefully touch on that later in the show. But first, tell us why you decided to run for Congress and why you think you're qualified and why you're running with the 9/11 truth as part of your central platform for your campaign.
Yes. Well, first off, thanks so much for the opportunity to be on the show again. I really appreciate it. An opportunity to get out important information.
Absolutely.
Well, the gist about my background that makes me qualified to run for Congress, and that I'm running, by the way, in California's Congressional District 20, which is essentially the Central Coast area of California centered around the Monterey Peninsula. So that's where I'm running. And there are five candidates running for the office. One of them, interestingly, my main rival here, is Leon Panetta's son, James Panetta. And many of your listeners will recognize Leon Panetta as having been CIA Director and Secretary of Defense. And the CIA Director and Secretary of Defense calls the shots on every Hellfire missile from every Predator drone and other drones over Afghanistan and Pakistan. And so his son is running for Congress on his father's bloodstained coattails. So I'm not only running for Congress on a 9/11 truth platform, but also against the unconscionable and clearly illegal under international law and U.S. law, by the way, and presidential executive orders, as far as I know, is still in existence, banning assassinations, and this is clearly an assassination program against, as we know, even U.S. citizens in Yemen. So I'm running for Congress, of course, not only on 9/11 truth and anti-drones, but also on a whole spectrum of positions on issues here that are relevant to the Central Coast. And why am I qualified? Well, if you look at the qualifications of the five of us running, there's absolutely no objective question that I'm by far the most qualified candidate. I'm the only candidate with any experience at the national level, period, let alone all of the high-level experience that I've had in the federal government, which included being a policy analyst in the Domestic Policy Council and the West Wing of the White House, in the Office of the President. I was the director of a task force for the Attorney General of the United States of the Department of Justice. And for 15 years, I was the senior military affairs journalist for the U.S. Navy at the Naval Postgraduate School here in Monterey, California, up until my retirement in June of 2011. And Department of Defense itself builds the Naval Postgraduate School, which is also known as NPS, as the abbreviation. The DOD builds NPS itself as the Department of Defense Premier Science, Technology, and National Security Affairs Graduate University of the Department of Defense. So I was a senior journalist there for a decade and a half, including before, during, and after 9/11. And finally, although there are many other qualifications besides my BS and Master's in Experimental Psychology, which is not directly, well, maybe it is directly relevant to the political
campaign. I think it is, yeah.
But the other qualification that I would think of besides being our family home 50 years, 5 decades on the Monterey Peninsula here in California, so I'm a local girl. The other qualification that comes to mind is that I have master's level certification in national security decision making from the Naval War College. So I guess that's about it in a nutshell.
Yeah, you sound very qualified. And why making 9/11 part of your campaign and part of why you want to run?
Well, that's very, very, very fundamental. And I have made 9/11, all of my 9/11 platform, extremely strong in radio interviews and interviews with our local newspapers that have been published in a very positive light, by the way. No heckling, no censorship, nothing.
That's fabulous.
Because these are effectively official statements. Because you can get 9/11 Truth out as a quasi-official statement when you are an official Secretary of State candidate for Congress. So the answer to your question, why is the truth about 9/11 that the official story is an incredible, huge, big lie? Why is that relevant to my run or anyone's run for Congress and what's happening in Washington and the world since 9/11? Well, the obvious answer for those of us who know the forensic facts about 9/11 is that 9/11 was used, it was an inside job, and it was used as the pretext for rolling out the entire militaristic global domination agenda, the list of a minimum, and there were actually more, but a minimum of known 7 nations per regime change in the Middle East, and the Bush, Cheney, and Obama administrations have now rolled down almost all of those 7 nations' regimes, according to the plan that was published the whole year before 9/11 by the Project for New American Century Zionist Neocons. So the bottom line is that 9/11 was used as the pretext, the official lie of 9/11 was used as the pretext for this massive rollout of the global domination agenda and the police and surveillance state, Patriot Act, Homeland Security, et cetera, in this country, which has resulted in, even on the known non-black budget, a minimum tripling of the so-called defense budget. Of course, it's now actually the offense department and not the defense department. So our country is hurting. It's hurting financially in every single way. Infrastructure is crumbling. People need health care. People need subsidies for higher education. And all of this money is being siphoned into 2 things in the federal budget. This ballooned offense department budget, based upon the pretext of the lie of 9/11, of the official story of 9/11, number one, and 2, the massively expanding and increasingly expanding section of the federal budget pie, this 100% pie, the section of that pie that goes to pay the federal debt on this massively expanding federal deficit, which in turn is based upon this massively ballooning offense department budget, Homeland Security budget, so-called intelligence budget, justified on the official lie of 9/11. So I make that link explicit in everything that I do here in this campaign so that people understand the reason they don't have money for the domestic side of the federal budget and everything that the American people need to nation build in our own country, which we desperately need, is because of the official lie of 9/11. So that's that in a nutshell.
Yeah, really well said. And it is all connected, and I hope that people see that. Now, what will you do when you get elected to promote 9/11 truth?
Right. Well, I have a long list, but I'll tell you the very, very first thing that I will do if I'm elected, and I intend to be. I'm fighting. I'm fighting really hard, and I'm going to tell you why there's a real chance here in a few minutes. When I am elected, the very first thing that I will do, besides joining the Progressive Caucus Congress, so that I would vote on most of the domestic side issues with the Progressive Caucus. So I'm running, I should make clear, as a Bernie Sanders independent. I'm 1,000% for Bernie Sanders for almost every policy that he puts forward. Some questions with some of his foreign policy and his deference to Israel, to the right-wing Likudists in Israel, but we'll put that aside. I'm talking about domestic policy. So anyway, I would join the Progressive Caucus immediately, and I would fight for major committee assignments, number 2. I would be an independent. Now, as far as I know, Bernie Sanders was the only independent, that is a registered, no party affiliation, independent for years as the senator from Vermont. And it was only relatively recently that he changed his party affiliation to Democrat. And he's technically running as a Democrat, as you know, against Hillary Clinton. So I believe I would be the only independent in Congress and that I would stand out. Anything that I did or said would probably far more easily get national media attention. All right, that's number 2. So number 3, the very first thing I would do for 9/11 would be to put into the congressional record with speech after speech after speech, ideally a filibuster, on the floor of the House of Representatives, recording the forensic facts that we know about 9/11 and the proof thereof in terms of citations, references, et cetera, into the congressional record. I would make 9/11 truth official. To my knowledge, I don't believe Cynthia McKinney did this. She held this magnificent congressional hearing on her own, which any member of Congress can do. And that's the fourth thing I would do. I would hold very hard-hitting, repeated series of congressional hearings in official congressional hearing rooms like Cynthia McKinney did when she was in Congress on 9/11 truth, on the forensic facts of 9/11 truth on all aspects of 9/11, leading up to, during, and after 9/11. I would do that, but I would also make sure that it was in the congressional record so that the information was officialized. And why is that important? It's important for the same reason that because I'm an official candidate for Congress here in California, the mainstream media here is quoting everything I say. During interviews, they're not censoring the interviews because it's official news, and it covers them legally. So when you get it in the official congressional record, it makes it safe for these legally risk-shy mainstream news outlets, newspapers, even television, to go ahead and quote it and talk about it. We have to learn how to officialize 9/11 truth. That's just the beginning of what I would do.
And even if you don't get elected, and I certainly hope you will, but even if you don't, as you said, you've been getting all of this out into the mainstream just through your campaign, so it's well worth it even if you don't get elected.
Absolutely. And I'd just like to let people know why I have a real chance of winning. This is not just a Don Quixote tilting at windmills here. Believe it or not, even though California's Congressional District 20, the Central Coast area around Monterey, California, goes up to Santa Cruz, California, which is highly progressive and independent. University of California, Santa Cruz campus is there. All those young students are of voting age and they vote. Believe it or not, when I was just at KSCO Radio, which is the main Santa Cruz station, it's got the strongest signal south of San Francisco before you get down to Los Angeles. It's a very powerful radio station. That's where I'm going to be blanketing the airwaves with ads coming up in the near future. I've already done a 10-spot ad just the other day on KSCO. KSCO did a Arbitron-type poll. They do this repeatedly so that their advertisers can know what their audience makeup is. And believe it or not, 56% of their listeners, it's a large listenership, are self-proclaimed political independents. 56%.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, 10% are other independent categories. In other words, not what they might call an official independent. And that would include Peace and Freedom Party, Constitution Party, maybe Greens Party, that kind of thing. So you've got almost three-quarters. three-quarters independent. Now, there's rarely been an actual self-proclaimed independent candidate with real qualifications they could vote for. So they usually vote Democratic. And as a result of that, our representatives since 1993... when I ran against him back then, Sam Farr is his name, he's now retiring. Therefore, the seat is open for the first time since 1993 when I ran last time. Now, Sam Farr won because the congressional district is heavily Democratic and he was the Democratic candidate. This time, Jimmy Panetta, Leon Panetta, former CIA director and Secretary of Defense, the drone warfare assassination program head himself, his son, James Panetta, Jimmy Panetta, is running as the Democrat on the ticket. Now, in the June 7th primary, Panetta Jr. will probably get the majority of the votes simply because people vote party. However, all I need to do on June 7th in the primary is be in the top two. And that's imminently doable because once I get in the top two, believe me, if I can knock out the only Republican running, who is a woman whose claim to fame is that she's on the city council in this little tiny town called Pacific Grove. If I can beat the Republicans and get on the November ballot, I will give James Panetta and the entire mentality of the Offense Department and the official eye of 9/11 a run for their money like you wouldn't believe. And because of the independent makeup of the KSO listenership, I think I have a very good chance.
Yeah, that sounds really great. And you mentioned the three candidates, Jimmy Panetta and then the Republican. Who are the other two?
There's a Republican and Democrat, and myself, an independent. There is one under self-proclaimed independent, in other words, no party affiliation given.
Uh-huh.
And his name is Jack Digby. He is a steel worker, and he has no political experience at all, really.
Mm-hmm.
He's in unions. He's a really good guy, I'm impressed with him. Very young, got a lot of maturing to do. And the fifth candidate is a really great guy. His name is Joe Williams. he's running on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket, so he's not technically an independent, although really he is. We agree on most issues, but again, he has absolutely no high-level political experience at the national level or even the state level, anything like that.
Do any of those candidates agree with you on 9/11?
Well, that's interesting. I have to tell you their response, because no one has actually come up to me and said, I agree with you. However, they're probably too hesitant to do that publicly, because I'm always with them in these candidate debate forums. Okay. And I've been in six or so candidate debate forums and have another half dozen of them coming up this month. The others were in March and April. But I have to tell you what happens in these debate forums, because you'll love this. I mean, I get a kick out of it. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
The 9/11 Truth Movement has obviously been so successful that almost everyone already knows about a lot of the main points of our evidence. They must know it, because I'm going to give you the example of a marina. Marina is a town on the coast here. It's part of the California Congressional District 20. And a few weeks ago, I was in a candidate forum that was televised live on our local public access TV station. And we were sitting at this very official dais of the Marina City Council, and, you know, the high leather chairs, the behind the wooden dais and all of this, all of us, plus the moderator. And the moderator, in all of these candidate forums, gives the same question to all candidates. We each have between a minute and 2 minutes to answer the same question. And then they rotate the order in which you answer. Okay. So, for example, one question was, what are you going to do about terrorism?
Oh.
Or what are you going to do about ISIS? How are you going to protect us from ISIS? Or how are you going to protect us from radical Islamic terrorism? Well, that just plays into my hands. And I said, well, first off, that answer presumes that the official story of who attacked our country on 9/11 is true, which it is, a blood libel, big lie. It is completely false.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Then I go into how we know. And I give one burning data point, I call it, flaming data point from World Trade Center and one flaming data point from the Pentagon. The World Trade Center data point I give, which I still to this day think outranks nanothermite by far, and that is, did you know that three independent official seismic records prove, these are official records, prove that there were massive deep basement explosions in both World Trade Centers 1 and 2 in both towers, in one case 14 seconds before and in the other 17 seconds before either plane hit at all. Dozens and dozens of stories into the sky above. Number one. Number two, do you know that what really happened at the Pentagon is the same as at the World Trade Center, pre-placed inside the building explosives, where no outside terrorist could ever have the opportunity to have the access to get inside the most highly secure access-controlled building on the planet? So I go into all of this, and I do it for a minute or two, hard-hitting like that, bullet point, bullet point, bullet point, and then I stop.
And
there isn't a single guffaw from the audience. None of the other candidates or the moderators raise their eyebrows. I've got this on video. What they do, the other candidates who then answer after me the same question, what are you going to do about terrorism, they act as if not a single word I said had been spoken.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that really amazing?
It is amazing.
Wow.
And Jimmy Panetta especially, of course, pushes the official line of 9/11, and he was a Navy intelligence reservist who went to Afghanistan, and his job was to identify so-called high-value targets, which were then given to his father when his father was CIA director, who then rained down Hellfire missiles on them and took out 90 to 95% innocent civilians around them.
And when they don't respond to you and they just ignore that and they go on, it makes them look like just total idiots, I think. I mean, it really shows.
Yes, it does.
The cover-up.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. And, oh, by the way, I mentioned Behind the Smoke Curtain. I mentioned the walking tour. I let people know where they can go find it. So I let people know. And, oh, you'll love this one. You'll love this one, Cheryl. One of the questions I was asked was, what are you going to do about ISIS? All the candidates were asked it. And I said, well, first off, that question presumes that ISIS is an outside terrorist organization. And number one, did you know that a man by the name of Gregory Ford, look him up on YouTube for yourself, Greg Ford was the only medic at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, and he personally recruited the self-proclaimed head of ISIS al-Baghdadi for U.S. intelligence. This is the man who, to this day, our U.S. Offense Department claims is the head of ISIS. Wow. He's ours. And did you know that al-Baghdadi, when he was injured in Syria, was raced by the Israelis to an Israeli hospital in the Golan Heights, where he was patched back to health and sent back into the battle in Syria? He's yeah. ours.
And you say this, and what kind of response do you get to that?
It's amazing, because I'm an official candidate. I'm on a level playing field with Panetta's son. I'm on this dais. Everybody knows I'm the one telling the truth. They can tell it from my tone of voice. They can tell it from the certainty in my voice. And they can see that all the other candidates are basically, they're assuming, put it this way, the official story about everything, about ISIS, about 9/11. And they listen with respect.
And the reporters, too. The journalists have to go along with that, too, right?
Well, the reporters have to quote you. That's their job.
Oh, I love this, Barbara. This is really great. I'm so thankful that you're doing this. Are you getting any feedback from the constituents about this?
Oh, yes. You know what's fascinating? Now, obviously, I hate the word politics, really. I am not a politician. I refuse to be one. I won't. By the way, everything is coming out of my own pocket, out of my own savings. And I'm just myself running to try to fix the country and the world. Okay, that's the bottom line. And you do that, you can't have justice without truth. And you can't fix things. You can't have democracy without the voting public knowing the facts. So that's why I'm doing it. I have a great faith in the truth working its magic once it's known by a critical mass of Americans.
Yeah.
So that, I have faith in the American voter when they're fully informed or reasonably informed. So anyway, what do these voters do? Well, in politics, and I hate the word, in politics, it's all about knowing individuals. So obviously, no individual candidate running can meet everybody who's going to be voting in the ballot booth. It's impossible. But for those who know me, for those who have met me, every single one has come up, and in many cases at these candidate forums after, when you kind of mill around and meet people, there was this woman who came up to me and she whispered, I'm going to vote for you. Like it was supposed to be a state secret.
Don't tell my neighbors.
But people who know me are actually excited. And one of the most exciting things to me is I just went to an event with Ray McGovern, who was out here in Santa Cruz. And I took out about $350 for 10 radio ads in KSCO Radio in Santa Cruz, plugging his event. And he spoke before and after a couple of nights ago. He spoke before and after a really great film called Drone, which everybody should see, and it's streamable from Netflix. You must see the documentary called just Drones, D-R-O-N-E-S. So Ray McGovern was out here, and Ray found out that I was running for Congress, and he got very excited about it, and I've asked him for his endorsement. We'll see what he does. He wanted me to send him all my materials, which I need to do. Michael Springman has endorsed me for office, and Michael Springman, of course, is the author of Visas for Al-Qaeda and was the consular State Department officer, the visa officer in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and has written this book, Visas for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I've interviewed him on the show, so some of the listeners will be aware of him.
Well, he's a very, very important person, and he's endorsed my candidacy. And as we get closer to the June 7th primary, I'm going to be holding 9/11 truth events under the umbrella of my candidacy. And I'm going to invite Michael out. I'm inviting Richard Gage. And I hope to have a major 9/11 campaign. Oh, also, Mike Gravel is coming. So I'm going to have a major campaign event here under my campaign umbrella for 9/11 truth with a lot of the experts and activists on the Monterey Peninsula before the campaign, before the primary on June 7th.
Excellent. That sounds really wonderful. Wow. Now,
and you know, Cheryl, it's actually fun.
I
ran for this office back in 1993, the last time the seat was open, when, coincidentally or not, Leon Panetta, who had been our representative for years in Congress, he, as you may recall, he stepped down in the middle of his term, the middle of his two-year term, in the House of Representatives to be Clinton's chief of staff in the White House. So there was a special election back in 1993, and I ran in that election. I was one of 26 candidates in that special election, and I actually got more votes per dollar spent by far than any other candidate in that election, including the winner, Sam Farr, who's now retiring at the end of this term. Yeah. So I kind of got all the bugs out back then. I'm actually enjoying the process.
That's great. And I really like the way you connect the dots between 9/11 and everything that's happening to our country, our budget, the wars. You connect it all, that we can't have health care for everybody because we're bombing seven countries in the Middle East, that kind of thing. So I really like the way you connect those dots.
We can't have health care, they claim. We can't have universal health care here because we're using the money to kill people overseas.
Exactly. And Americans should be outraged that, really, that we're killing all these, you know, aside from the money, that we're killing millions of innocent people in the Middle East and around the world. It's really a travesty.
Yes, yes. And what you learn from the movie Drones, and especially from my friend and colleague, I'm sure if you haven't interviewed her on the show, you should, Margie Cohn. She's written the book Drones. She is fantastic. And Margie Cohn's book and this new documentary film Drones, you can download and stream from Netflix. They prove that our military is intentionally targeting civilians. Intentionally targeting civilians.
Yeah.
And if you believe their lie, that we know that they intentionally targeted and took out with a drone attack in Yemen this former alleged motivator, this imam motivator of alleged terrorists. They took him out. He was an American citizen. But a little bit later in a separate drone attack, they claim that it was just an accident that the Hellfire missile happened to take out his son, who's also an American citizen.
Right. Wasn't he sitting in a sidewalk cafe when they took him out?
Exactly. And these Hellfire missiles home in on the cell phone that the person is on, the cell phone number, the GPS locator.
Makes you want to get rid of your cell phone. Anyway, Barbara, one last question, because we mentioned this in the beginning. Can you talk a little bit about, just briefly, about the book October Surprise that you wrote back in, was it the 80s?
Sure. I'm glad you brought it up, because my book, October Surprise, the bottom line of that book, and it was the first by almost 3 years before the next published at all by anyone else, and that was by Gary Sick, who was the naval intelligence officer who was in the Carter White House National Security Council throughout the hostage crisis. He wrote a book by the same title, October Surprise, is mine 3 years later. Didn't mention my book, of course, just stole everything. But anyway, my book has been magnificently confirmed by now declassified documents that everyone can go read for themselves on Robert Perry's fantastic website called consortiumnews.com. Just click on the October Surprise X-Files for those documents, proving it that were formally classified and have now been leaked. And what's so fantastic, Cheryl, is that just the other day, believe it or not, in Newsweek magazine. Now, I've just read it in the online Newsweek, but just, I think it was April 26th or something like that. Could still be the current or just past issue of Newsweek, at least the online version. There is a big headline, "The October Surprise is Real," claims former top CIA spy on his deathbed. That man was Duane Dewey Claridge, who is at the center of the Iran-Contra felonies and was one of the five Iran-Contra felons who was actually indicted and had to be pardoned by George Bush Sr. as one of his last acts as President of the United States. So my book, October Surprise, was proof and has now been validated by even the guy who was in charge of the operation on the Contra side of Iran-Contra, Duane Dewey Claridge, in Newsweek magazine the other day. My book, October Surprise, proves that the Reagan-Bush Sr. campaign in 1980 literally stole the election from President Carter. Can you imagine what the world would have been like if Carter had won a second?
Yeah, it's really like
a
it's like a coup, a secret coup there, you know.
It was a coup. It was a CIA coup led by George Bush Sr. and William Casey, who became Reagan's first head of the CIA, not coincidentally.
Yeah.
And it's now been totally confirmed. So I've been just recently validated in Newsweek magazine.
Well, it's a perfect time while you're running your campaign. It's good to have that validation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You could imagine I mention it on the campaign trail.
You've got it down, Barbara. It sounds really great. And I want to thank you for running and bringing all this to
thank
the surface.
You.
And thank you for all your work on 9/11 Truth and all the other issues we all care about. Great to have you on the show today.
Well, great to be on.
And again, you were just listening to longtime 9/11 Truth activist Barbara Honegger discuss her current run for Congress from the 20th Congressional District in California on a 9/11 Truth platform. She has worked inside the government for much of her adult life. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people!
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, Lily Tomlin appeared as her character Ernestine at a California rally in support of the Medicare for All single-payer system. But first,
one of the critical issues, surely, for the election season and for our lives, Medicare for All, a better prescription for a healthcare solution. Bernie Sanders is at the forefront over a national debate on improving our healthcare system with his proposal for a single-payer structure, shorthand for Medicare for All. Meanwhile, in New York State, Assemblyman Richard Gottfried's single-payer legislation did pass the Assembly with wide support from organized labor as well as a multiple of community advocacy and healthcare professional organizations. While discontent arises over Obamacare, as insurance companies increase our out-of-pocket expenses, the Gottfried plan would provide a comprehensive universal insurance program for all New Yorkers without deductibles, co-pays, and would eliminate restrictive provider networks.
Gottfried's plan would begin a march to Medicare for All nationwide, the same state-by-state way the Canadians began their successful single-payer system. Gottfried said, "Healthcare reform has done a lot of good, but it still leaves us in the hands of insurance companies. Single-payer would save the billions of dollars that we now spend on insurance company administrative costs. You and your doctor would work to keep you healthy. New York Health would pay the bill with funding from broad-based revenue based on ability to pay."
And we'd like to welcome Assemblyman Dick Gottfried. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So first of all, are you excited that we have Bernie Sanders in the sense of having evoked from the populace and provoked a debate that raises, probably in a way that we haven't been seen before, the issue of a single-payer Medicare for All healthcare system?
Very definitely. I think the fact that Bernie Sanders has put improved Medicare for All, single-payer coverage, in the spotlight in this year's debates has been enormously valuable. You know, so many people would say, oh, everyone knows single-payer is the only sensible way to do things, but it'll never happen. We're working to change that conversation so that people understand that it is something achievable. I believe that the more people talk about the issue, hear about the issue, that helps change it from being could never happen to being achievable and then to being almost inevitable. So I'm really very excited about all the discussion this year. I've been in this effort for since the early 90s. Time not only has come, but is long overdue.
And what is there in the Affordable Care Act that needs to be built on or improved?
You know, the Affordable Care Act, well, does a lot of improving in an insurance-based system. The problem is that it leaves us with an insurance-based system, and that means rising premiums that have no relation to ability to pay, more and more plans with large and growing deductibles and co-pays, and restricted provider networks with no out-of-plan benefit. You know, there's a Chinese expression, you cannot carve rotten wood. There's just so much improvement you can make in an insurance company-based system when you have to realize that you really can't get there from here. It really requires fundamental change. You know, almost every problem that we face in healthcare, whether as patients or as healthcare providers or taxpayers or employers, is made worse and harder to solve because of the fact that we have this insurance-based system. And it's got to change. You know, before the Affordable Care Act was passed, a lot of people said, well, why don't we try something like Massachusetts did, see if that works. Well, that's what the Affordable Care Act is, and it's now pretty clear that while it has fixed a couple of problems, it has left us with all of the big problems of the insurance industry.
And a lot of people are very concerned about the implementation of the so-called Cadillac tax in a couple of years. Could you comment on that?
The so-called Cadillac tax is the Affordable Care Act's way of trying to, you know, essentially punish health plans that are considered too generous. And so it says that if you've got a plan that, spends more than a certain amount or is better by a variety of criteria, it's going to be paying a huge tax, literally a tax to the government. That's either going to make these plans, and a lot of union negotiated plans are in this category, it's either going to make them impossibly expensive, or it is going to force unions and management to retrench and have much less reasonable plans, which means that workers will either go without care or more and more of the cost of care will be pushed onto the backs of workers who are the least able to afford it.
One of the things that I'm concerned about, and I wonder how you feel about this now, in Vermont, there's been a setback. The governor reversed his position on supporting a single-payer health care system. So why do you think it would work in New York?
You know, in Vermont, there were a couple of problems. One was at the point where the governor would have had to go ahead or not with a tax package, he was really on thin ice politically. He had just come through an election in which he only got a plurality of the vote, which meant that his election was in the hands of the legislature. So he was in a very dicey position. And under their plan, they left out of the plan some of the largest employers in the state, which means they lost out on a lot of the savings that come with a single-payer system, and they lost out on a lot of the revenue that would have come from including the biggest and highest wage employers. So naturally, the taxes look out of control. We've done a very detailed economic analysis how the New York Health Act would be financed in New York, and what we found was that 98% of New York households will be paying less in the premiums that will be owed under the New York Health Act versus the premiums and deductibles and other out-of-pocket costs that people now pay. You're going to have to be a very wealthy taxpayer to be paying more under the New York Health Act than you are spending today. And, you know, one of the reasons why those numbers work is that New York is about the world's most amazingly productive economy. It distributes its productivity unfairly, but it generates a huge amount of income. And that will enable this plan to work very economically. It's also not clear, by the way, that in Vermont they really took a full accounting of all the savings that would come with a single-payer plan. But we have had a solid academic study done of the New York Health Act, both the savings that it will produce by eliminating insurance company administrative costs and the administrative costs that providers spend for fighting insurance companies. And even after you account for picking up out-of-pocket expenses and covering the uninsured, we would be saving $45 billion a year in New York.
There has been an enormous amount of support, certainly in New York, from both public and private sector organized labors. What would be the significance of this for the large number of undocumented workers who are not protected?
Well, first of all, let's talk a little about organized labor, because organized labor is the most potent political force in New York State, and union-negotiated health plans are increasingly seeing that it's becoming really unaffordable and is sucking all the oxygen out of the room when they have to sit down and negotiate with management. And all the resources go into defending the union health plan, and there's nothing left over practically to fight for wages and other benefits. For undocumented New Yorkers, the plan would cover everyone who is here, as I always say, you know, however they got here, whether they, you know, fell from the sky or what have you, every New Yorker would be covered. But we've actually done that in New York before. In 1990, when we enacted our child health insurance plan, we covered every child in New York who is income eligible without regard to their immigration status.
Could you give us an idea of what kind of coverage we're talking about, and especially also with regard to that, whether drugs would be covered?
Yeah. Well, it would be the most comprehensive coverage that anybody in New York has or has ever had. It would cover anything that is now covered by any of the following: Medicaid, Medicare, the public employee health package, the mandates in the insurance law, and anything else that the program chooses to add. So it would cover doctors, non-doctor healthcare professionals, the hospitals, prescription drugs, dental, vision, all of those things would be covered, and they'd be covered better than we now have, because there would be no restricted provider network. There would be no deductibles or copays, no financial barriers to health care whatsoever, which to me is what it ought to be. If you believe that we have an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you can't achieve those things if you've got if you have financial barriers to health care.
We are speaking with Richard Godfrey, the chair of the New York State Assembly Health Committee, and we are speaking about Medicare for All. Some people refer to it as single payer. And one of the things that I was interested in, so at this juncture, what has to be done to get the Senate to take up the bill? Now, I mentioned that it passed the new assembly, but certainly, how do we get it passed? What needs to be done organizationally to get it through the Senate?
To get it passed in the state Senate, my colleague, Senator Bill Perkins, who carries the bill in the state Senate, as he puts it, we either need to change some minds or change some personnel. And I guess realistically, it may require changing some personnel in the state Senate. What I believe is that as this issue becomes more known to more New Yorkers and people come to see it as something that is really achievable, then it becomes something that people are going to demand of their candidates. You know, just as today people say, you know, where do you stand on school aid and what do you feel about clean elections and ethics and the rent laws? I think if people start asking their candidates, where do you stand on getting rid of the financial barriers between me and my family getting health care, I think that's going to help change the character of the state Senate.
And what about the Independent Democratic Caucus and also our dear governor?
You know, I think the Independent Democratic Caucus, so-called, you know, they're part of the groups that we're looking to persuade. And I expect they will be easier to persuade than Republicans. And also, if we elect three or four more Democrats, I think all of a sudden the state Senate changes dramatically. And I think in this year's election, that's a real possibility. As for the governor, we haven't approached the governor yet. I think to bring him on board, we need to bring a lot more public and labor support, a lot more political support in the legislature. You know, without outing any of his staff, I would say that if this were put to a vote of health policy people who now work for the state of New York in the executive branch, I think it would pass.
Assemblyman, you've already indicated that it would be a tremendous boon for labor by taking health insurance off the table, which would free up money such as for wage and pension increases.
Yeah.
I'm interested in your thoughts on the public sector unions, such as the teachers unions and CSEA and PEF. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it also have special significance for them?
It would, in that they have very good health plans, but are very expensive to sustain. And, you know, politically, you've got You've got people in the private sector who look at the pensions that public employees get and the health benefits, and they say, you know, why are you folks getting this and I don't? I'm paying the taxes for a school teacher who makes more than I do to get good health coverage. The New York Health Act would eliminate that whole dynamic. Every New Yorker would have the same health coverage that Michael Bloomberg or George Soros or the governor or me or the janitor where they work would all be in the same boat with the same top-notch coverage. And by the way, several of our public employee unions are very much on board. The New York State United Teachers, the UFT, is on board. The New York State Nurses Association, which will point out to you that their largest bargaining union is the New York City Public Hospitals. So they are in many ways a public employee union. So there are both public and private sector unions on board. One issue with the labor movement is that for labor leaders who run for re-election among their union members, they consider the union health plan a big plus as, you know, what they deliver for their members. And it certainly is. But I think more and more union leaders are coming to understand that it's really an albatross around organized labor's neck, because it's becoming more and more expensive, more and more the plans are getting more and more restrictive. And the New York Health Act would really free up unions to focus on wages and vacations and other benefits.
And one of the things also that would seem to me is quite significant here is that it would eliminate the portion of taxes paid by localities to also cover Medicaid.
Yes. There are two real tax benefits to localities. Number one, New York is the only state in the union that requires counties and New York City to pay part of the cost of Medicaid. And under the New York Health Act, we would end that. The second way it would benefit municipalities for every level of government, since they are employers, and they are employers that typically have fairly good employee health benefits, by dramatically lowering the cost of health coverage, it would especially benefit cities, counties, towns, the state, and in turn, lighten the burden on taxpayers.
So in the remaining minute that we have left, Assemblyman Dick Gottfried, why do we need a single-payer health care system, Medicare for all? Give us that wonderful soundbite.
We need to get rid of the financial obstacles between families and health care and financial stability. We need to get insurance company costs out of the picture, and we need to distribute the cost of health care more fairly. And that's what improved Medicare for all would do.
And we need to tell every one of our legislators to get on board with Medicare for all supports single-payer system, right?
Absolutely. And it may take a long time for it to happen in Washington, but in a state like New York, I think we can get it done.
And that's the way the Canadians started it, with province by province, state by
yes,
state.
Yes, indeed. Yep.
Well, we want to thank Richard Gottfried, who has been on the case for quite some time and is kindling the spirit in the rest of us to do what we must. Medicare for all, a much better prescription for a health care solution. Richard Gottfried is the chair of the New York State Assembly Health Committee, and we thank you for your work. And we're going to get it. We're going to get it. We're going to be New York State that has a single-payer system to support all of our residents with quality healthcare.
Well, thanks for helping get the word out. That's how we're going to get it done.
And thanks for writing the bill.
Okay. Bye-bye.
I have a dream.
Healthcare.
One day.
Justice. Healthcare. Justice.
America of the people. America by the people. America for the people. Which people are you talking about? Are you talking about the wealthy with the means to stay healthy while 47 million go without? No doubt, we need a revolution. It's time for a brand new healthcare solution. Sing it on behalf of the uninsured, because I believe it's so absurd. For America, the so-called greatest nation,
to be in a healthcare crisis situation.
Someday, this nation will rise up.
Justice. Come from the land of milk and honey.
United we stand, uh-huh. Divided we fall.
But the healthcare industry's addicted to money.
All for one, not one for all.
7 million in dire straits,
excluded by greed and wealth.
So we got to get united in these states
and put the care back in health.
Come on, y'all. Sing healthcare justice for all. How can you sleep knowing you make promises you never keep? Life is short and talk is cheap. Time has come for you to earn your keep. Money and politics corrupting democracy, creating a hopeless healthcare hypocrisy. It's hard to see beyond your illusion. A misconception lies and confusion. Melting pot.
Or is this a false accusation
of the have to haves and the have to have nots?
Waiting in anticipation.
Sing up hell like Johnny on the spot
in every other industrialized nation.
So when will we have what we have not got? Talking about a do or die situation.
Oh, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied. Justice rolls down like waters. And righteousness like a mighty stream.
Healthcare Justice was composed and performed by Charlotte Washington.
We're going to hook up now with comedian actress Lily Tomlin, who appeared as her character Ernestine, the irascible phone operator representative from the now classic TV comic variety show Laughing, at a California rally in support of healthcare for all. Lily adopts Ernestine's role to play a representative of an HMO. And if you think she was funny then, wait till you hear her now.
There she is right behind me. Thank you all. Oh, it's so great to see you all. Thank you. Thank you for having so much energy, so much spirit to come out here. Stand here in the sun. It's inspiring. It's moving. It's motivating. I have been so incredibly worried. I'm just proud to be here at this rally for One Care. And I have to tell you, I do worry. I worry so much because the way you give me a different kind of inspiration, because I usually worry no matter how cynical you become, it's never enough to keep up. But being here today gives me another kind of impetus. Okay, now, I've prepared an Ernestine routine for you. Some of you know Ernestine, some of you don't. But Ernestine used to be a telephone operator at AT&T. And, of course, with the divestiture, she couldn't stand that loss of power. So she's moved over to another industry. Care Control Insurance Corp. Claims Department. Ernestine Tomlin speaking. State your record number and be quick about it. Your name is not important. Here we do everything by the numbers. Ka-ching, ka-ching. Oops, and your number is up. Care Control, what's your gripe du jour? No, not covered. You should have read the fine print. Ernestine Tomlin claims, no, that your plan does not cover that. That's an exclusion. No, an exclusion, as in exclude, meaning leave out, cut out, shut out, expel, remove from consideration, make impossible, not going to happen, forget it, don't make me laugh. Hello, Earth to you, exclusion. It's your nickel. Speak up. You were shot in a subway. Next time, eat at Quiznos. Ernestine claims, oh, you haven't yet seen a doctor? Well, good, sir, let's get a specimen of your problem. Remove all your clothing and fold it neatly on a chair. Yes, all of it. Oh, no, now don't be that way. After all, your secretary is a professional person. Good, sir. Now take your instrument, sit on it, turn your head and cough. Oh, I love this job. Ernestine claims no can do. No, sir. No, we consider that an elective procedure, meaning we elect not to pay for it. It's not our fault you've had two heart attacks. You should have stopped at one. Tell me, does heart disease run in the family? So, the apple doesn't collapse far from the tree. Next life, learn from Dick Cheney. Don't have a heart. Ernestine, angel of mercy, not. Calm down. I can't understand a word you're screaming. I know your hand is broken. You told me that yesterday. Yes, I have your request. You're begging for surgery form in triplicate. Request denied. I can't read this third copy. Next time, press harder. Your family doctor is not in our coverage area. No. Our nearest preferred provider is, let's see, if you hop on a plane right now, you might get there before the blood clot travels to your brain. No, the only way I can help is if you go to an acupuncturist. No, we don't cover acupuncture. I was just needling you. You must think HMO stands for help me out. We don't care if you're fed up, just if you're paid up. Don't you get it? It takes big bucks to run an insurance company. Medical care is the least of it. You wouldn't believe the paperwork. All this waste doesn't come cheap. Remember, here at Care Control, your health is our business, not our concern. Thank you all. Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Why is
everyone arguing about bathrooms now.
There have been very few complaints the way it is.
Let the states decide.
This opens the door for all kinds of issues with men deciding one day that they want to be women and then switching back the next day.
I'm Coco Peru, and I'm here because it's an opportunity to meet fans who are coming from all over the country.
My name is David Yost. I originally played Billy the Blue Ranger on the television series The Mighty Morphin Power Rangers.
I'm Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and I'm here selling my brand at the RuPaul Drag Con.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Japan plans LGBT-friendly workplace policies, anti-equality states revolt against Obama's bathroom guidelines, and drag icons convene at DragCon 2016. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending May 28, 2016. The Japanese government announced late this week that revised guidelines it will release in January define employment discrimination against LGBT people as sexual harassment. The Kyoto News Agency reported that officials with the Health, Labor, and Welfare Ministry said on May 26th that changes to the Equal Employment Opportunity Law include strengthening existing guidelines that already require companies to punish employees who sexually harass LGBT people. Four opposition parties submitted a bill the following day to the Diet, the country's legislative body, to ban all forms of discrimination against sexual minorities, though its passage is iffy at best. The measure would require governments at all levels to prepare basic plans to deter discrimination and would also prohibit private companies from discriminating against LGBT people. The bill generally demands that government and private employers abolish all practices that hamper LGBT people in their daily life.
A high-profile South Korean gay couple said this week that they plan to appeal the Seoul Western District Court's May 25th ruling that denied legal status to the marriage ceremony the couple famously celebrated on a scenic bridge in Seoul in September 2013. They filed suit in May 2014 after the Seoul District Office rejected their marriage registration because same-sex marriage does not satisfy the definition of husband and wife in civil law. The district court agreed this week that the marriage of Kim Sung-hwan and Kim Seok-kwang-su could not be recognized under current law and said that it was up to the legislature to change it. On the day the appeal was announced, Kim told reporters that, "I hope the judiciary takes courage and makes a decision instead of pushing the responsibility to the legislative body." He called on other gay and lesbian couples to come out of the closet and join us. Ryu Min-hee, the attorney for movie director Kim and his longtime spouse, announced that, in fact, two more same-gender couples had already filed separate marriage equality lawsuits that day.
A measure in the United States Congress to protect LGBT rights had a bumpy roller coaster ride this week. Authored by out New York Democrat Sean Patrick Maloney, it would uphold President Barack Obama's executive order protecting LGBT workers against bias by federal contractors. The Republican-dominated House infamously removed that amendment from a major defense spending bill last week after seven members were pressured to change their votes to defeat it. The proposal was approved in an energy and water spending bill this week, but removed again the following day. The energy and spending bill then failed. Some are predicting that no other spending bills are going to pass the House anytime soon because of the bitter battle over LGBT civil rights within the Republican Party. GOP insiders who were there told CNN that a Georgia Republican member opened an early morning caucus meeting with a prayer that warned party colleagues that any member who backed the LGBT provision was going to hell. That prompted some of them to walk out of the meeting. Pity, if you will, House Speaker Paul Ryan, who's already under pressure for, at least as we record this newscast, not yet endorsing GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump. He reluctantly took the Speaker's job amidst an already fractured Republican Party after John Boehner unexpectedly quit and resigned from Congress late last year. Ryan now has another internal squabble he doesn't want to have to deal with.
The government in the tiny Micronesian island of Nauru announced on May 27th that its parliament had passed the Crimes Act 2016 to bring the independent nation's century-old criminal code up to international human rights standards. Laws against same-gender sex were repealed. The act also decriminalized attempted suicide, abolished the death penalty, and ended imprisonment at hard labor and solitary confinement. About 10,000 people call Nauru home. It's located in the South Pacific, northeast of Australia. The government of Seychelles repealed its century-old sodomy law last week. About 93,000 people call one of the 115 African islands in the Indian Ocean home. The colonial era law punished private consensual adult gay sex with up to 14 years in prison. Politically powerful Christian church leaders loudly voiced their opposition. But Seychelles Foreign Affairs Minister Joel Morgan said that a sin is not determined by the government, but by religion. Each individual needs to follow his or her conscience on the issue. President James Michel prevailed after announcing his intention to repeal the law during his State of the Nation address in February. 14 lawmakers voted in favor, 14 abstained, at least some probably feeling that church pressure, and 4 members were absent.
Private consensual adult gay sex was illegal in Australia until the 1980s, and even the early 90s in some states. Victoria's Labour Party Premier Daniel Andrews made his state the first in the country this week to formally apologize to the gay men who were prosecuted under those buggery statutes that even outlawed homosexual loitering, a vague offense allowing the wholesale persecution of gay people just for existing. In a moving speech to Parliament on May 24th, Andrews recounted stories of some of the gay men who had suffered injustices under those laws and defined the path forward.
It is our responsibility to prove that the Parliament that engineered this prejudice can also be the Parliament that ends it. Speaker, there is no more simple an acknowledgement than this. There was a time in our history when we turned thousands of ordinary young men into criminals, and it was profoundly and unimaginably wrong.
Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews.
Meanwhile, so-called conversion therapy to make LGBT teens normal has been outlawed in the U.S. state of Vermont. California, New Jersey, Oregon, Illinois, New York, Washington, D.C., and the city of Cincinnati have already banned the controversial practice. Democratic Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin signed the bill on May 25th, issuing a statement that said it was absurd to think that being gay or transgender is something to be cured of.
Let's now catch up on the latest developments in the two leading U.S. hate states. North Carolina, with its law banning local LGBT civil rights ordinances and forbidding trans people from using gender-segregated public facilities, like bathrooms, in which they feel most comfortable, and Mississippi, with its so-called religious freedom law, allowing both private and public workers to refuse to serve LGBT people based on sincerely held religious belief. The hospitality state's Republican Governor Phil Bryant continues to staunchly defend the law despite mounting losses in Mississippi's vital tourism business and official travel bans issued by a number of U.S. state and city governments. A growing list of entertainers have either canceled shows in Mississippi or donated proceeds to local LGBT advocacy groups. Even the European Union has weighed in, declaring that the laws in Mississippi and North Carolina each violate international human rights treaties.
The latest performers to cancel concerts in North Carolina just this week included celebrated violinist Itzhak Perlman and the pop group Maroon 5. The Dave Matthews Band held its scheduled concert in Charlotte, but donated part of the proceeds to local LGBT-supportive organizations. The largest Latino civil rights and advocacy organization in the U.S., the National Council of La Raza, announced that it's moving a conference out of the Tar Heel State to protest the anti-LGBT law known as HB2.
The San Francisco 49ers of the National Football League donated $75,000 to the LGBT Equality North Carolina Foundation to further their work. The National Basketball Association is still reportedly considering moving next year's All-Star Game out of Charlotte. Lawmakers in that city were scheduled this week to discuss repealing their local LGBT anti-discrimination ordinance. Its passage prompted the state legislature to overturn it, which created the firestorm that's been raging for the past few months. But discussion of repeal was removed from the agenda just prior to the city council meeting without explanation. There was no announcement about whether it might be part of a future agenda.
And finally, lawyers for the University of North Carolina system told a federal court in a civil lawsuit filed specifically against it, in addition to state government officials, that it won't enforce the part of HB 2 that requires trans students to use restrooms corresponding to the gender on their birth certificate. The declaration came in a motion asking the court to halt those proceedings while a higher court decides a separate case on transgender rights from Virginia. The University of North Carolina system stands to lose millions of dollars in federal funding because of HB 2. UNC attorneys stressed in their May 27th filing that the university system has not changed any of its policies or practices regarding transgender students or employees. And they concluded that there is nothing in the law that prevents any transgender person from using the restroom consistent with his or her gender identity. There was no response by the time we recorded this newscast from officials with North Carolina's dominant Republican majority, led by Governor Pat McCrory. But they're not likely to be pleased by a state university system, apparently, hollering uncle.
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 28, 2016, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm John Dyer V.
What is your favorite thing at DragCon?
Seeing everybody. You'll see like 10, 15, 20 people that you recognize from the internet, which is really rad.
If you happen to keep a tiara in your closet, you'll want to dig it out later in the program.
Step to the left, now step to the right. Put your knees together and squeeze them tight. Keep your arms moving side to side. Try to hold it in till it's time to ride. Knock, knock, let me in. Knock, knock, let me in. I gotta go, Knock, knock, let me in. Knock, knock, let me in. I gotta go.
Texas led more than a dozen U.S. states in a federal lawsuit this week, challenging the Obama administration's guidelines concerning transgender students in public schools that receive federal funding. The original plaintiffs included Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Utah, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. Soon, far-right Maine Governor Paul LePage, the Arizona Department of Education, two school districts in Arizona and Texas, and Mississippi's Governor Phil Bryant joined in. Their target is the interpretation of federal civil rights laws that ban discrimination based on sex issued by the U.S. Justice and Education Departments in mid-May. A number of courts have already agreed that those provisions protect transgender people, too. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton took the opportunity to demonstrate his total ignorance about transgender people when he told Fox News why he was leading the charge.
This opens the door for all kinds of issues with men deciding one day that they want to be women and then switching back the next day. It doesn't answer any particular question.
A statement issued by ACLU LGBT rights director James Essex pointed out that the Obama administration didn't make the law. It simply applied the law and guidelines. Essex called the lawsuit a political stunt, saying that if these attorneys general disagree with the agency's interpretation of what the federal ban on sex discrimination means, they can make that argument to the court when it arises in a real case. In a Fox News candidate debate in April, now presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump said he thought it was silly to worry about which bathrooms transgender people use.
People go, they use the bathroom that they feel is appropriate. There has been so little trouble.
So if Caitlyn Jenner were to walk into Trump Tower and want to use the bathroom, you would be fine with her using any bathroom she chooses?
That is correct.
However, this week, Trump did the backstroke into muddy waters during an appearance on ABC's Jimmy Kimmel Live.
I thought this was very interesting. You believe that transgender people should be able to use whatever bathroom they want to, which is contrary to what a lot of people, most people in your party, believe. Why do you think people are focused on that?
What really I'm saying is, and I think it's pretty simple, let the states decide.
And, you know, we have to protect everybody. It's a very, very small group. Right now, it's a very small group. Perhaps
but would
it's
you say,
larger.
Though, if you were voting personally or a member of, in New York State, that you would vote for that right?
Well, the party generally believes that whatever you're born, that's the bathroom you use.
Well, okay? What about you?
I say let the states decide. And I just say let the states
Do you personally
decide.
Support it? I think you do.
What I support is let the states decide. And I think the states will do, hopefully, the right thing.
And what's the right thing?
I don't know yet. I mean, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. It's a very interesting
It's the stupidest
subject.
Thing to be focused on.
No,
don't
no,
we have
I mean,
much
the world,
bigger
the
problems?
The world is blowing apart. And,
yes.
You know, lots of bad things are happening. And a lot of, but you know what? It's something has to be discussed. But I say let the states decide.
Perhaps all the opponents of the Obama administration's transgender guidelines should take notes during this abbreviated but pointed history lesson from NBC's Late Night with Seth Meyers.
Why is everyone arguing about bathrooms now? Well, it turns out this move is nothing new. In fact, fighting over bathrooms is the oldest move in the Prejudice playbook. And if you're not into books, it's also available as a digital download. America has a long history of using bathrooms to scare people, and it makes sense because bathrooms are pretty scary to begin with. You're cut off from the world, your pants are down, the lighting is terrible. And politicians are happy to exploit that fear. But first, a little history. Separate bathrooms for men and women began in the 1800s when women started working in factories. Women needed bathrooms, whereas men were shocked to learn women even used bathrooms. They just assumed back then that everything women ate turned to babies. Which is why, true story, to this day, we call children little historical fact. Now, after the Civil War, Jim Crow laws forced African Americans to use different bathrooms than white Americans. And then in the 1980s, there was a movement to keep gay men from using public restrooms because people were afraid they'd catch AIDS from a toilet seat. Of course, that can't happen. But telling a minority group that they're not allowed to use the same bathroom everyone else uses is a well-worn strategy used to make minorities feel like crap, pun intended. But proponents of the so-called bathroom bill don't want you to see their bills as prejudice. They want you to think they're trying to protect the children.
As the father of daughters, I'm not terribly excited about men being able to go alone into a bathroom with my daughters.
When you start bringing in 7-year-old children co-mixing in the bathroom, it's going to be chaos.
First of all, these guidelines are not forcing boys and girls to shower together. Second of all, anywhere 7-year-olds co-mix, it's going to be chaos. But it turns out that's another classic move used against minority groups, painting them as child predators. Just ask gay men. For decades, they were barred from being teachers or scout leaders, even though study after study has shown there is zero correlation between being a child molester and being gay. When conservatives claim that trans people are preying on children, then that they shouldn't be allowed to use the bathroom they want to use, it's not a response to an actual problem. It's an age-old scam used to mobilize people against a vulnerable minority group. You know who actually needs protection? Trans people. 25% of trans Americans have lost their job because of their identity. 20% have been homeless at some point. 90% have been denied health care. And 70% of trans people have experienced some form of harassment in a public bathroom. The idea that trans people are a dangerous presence in bathrooms or a threat to our children is a lie. And worse, it's not even a new lie. It's the oldest lie in the book.
A so-called bathroom bill to outlaw trans people using the public facilities of their choice is now pending in the Oklahoma state legislature. In the same way that state bans on civil marriage for same-gender couples were ultimately overturned, challenges to these discriminatory anti-trans laws will probably be decided in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
We are what we are, and what we are is an illusion. We love how it feels, putting on heels, causing confusion. We face life, though it's sometimes sweet and sometimes bitter. Face life with a little guts and lots of bitter.
under our frocks, turtles and chucks, proving we are what we are.
We dispatched our intrepid entertainment correspondent to the Los Angeles Convention Center on May 7th and 8th, where he mysteriously disappeared into a cloud of glitter. Oh, wait, there he is.
This is Steve Fry on the floor of RuPaul's DragCon. In its second year, the event is bigger and better than ever before. So let's meet just a few of the incredibly fierce people around me. Tell me who you are and why you're here.
I'm Coco Peru, and I'm here because it's an opportunity to meet fans who are coming from all over the country. So for me, it's just amazing to have people that will actually stand on the line and want to give me a hug and tell me how much they love me. It's a treat for me, really.
Is it awkward to be a lady like you in a room full of drag queens?
Not at all. I feel right at home with my drag sisters. This lighting could be better, I'll be honest, but what are you going to do?
My name is David Yost. I originally played Billy the Blue Ranger on the television series The Mighty Morphin Power Rangers back in the 90s. It was the number one children's show. And fortunately for me, the success of the show has gone on and on and on. Here I am 20 years later, and I get to travel around the world and do lots of Comic-Cons, and I get to meet fans from all over the world and hear some amazing stories about how Power Rangers influenced their lives. In the 90s, being gay in Hollywood was not easy. And as an actor, it's something that you didn't really want people to know because it really would have an effect on your acting career. I mean, the people that I was working with, they might have suspected that I was gay, but I never confirmed yes or no. And when I was working on the TV show, I wasn't dating people. I wasn't doing anything within the gay world. If anybody were to ask me if I was gay back then, I would tell them no. So coming out was a difficult process for me. I had to go through a lot of mental issues within myself that I had to overcome. And eventually I did that. And at the age of 30 years old, I came out.
My name is Craig Ramsey, and I paired up with Pandora Box Drag Star for Workouts of Drag, which is the most fun, entertaining fitness program to ever hit the market. And what we wanted to create with Workouts of Drag is just a fun fitness experience that takes the pressure off of the reps and sets and all the boring factors and the factors that make you feel like crap when you work out. We eliminate those. It's a fun exercise program that is highly effective because it's interval training, raising your heart rate up and lowering it down to be able to burn chemicals, ATP and creatine, which burn fat. So it's fun, yet effective.
You're also a reality star.
Well, yes, I have been on TV. My husband and I were featured on Newlyweds the first year on Bravo Season 3, and we had a great time with that. It was such a pleasure to be able to take America into what a gay marriage looks like, because we were the first legally married gay couple on TV. And the response is incredible. I think that we're so flattered that all of these straight couples across America found our marriage relatable. And the plethora of messages that we got from people saying, I have to apologize, I voted against gay marriage. I didn't believe in this until I saw it. So that was our intention, and that's what we were able to provide America.
Hi, I'm Leisha. I have a new product called Pet Wigs, and it's a wig for your pet. This was our launch. We're at DragCon right now, and it's going amazingly. Everybody who rounds the corner to see our booth is laughing hysterically, which is what we want. There's 1,000 costumes for pets, but nobody did the hair. So you can't really ever complete the outfit. So we wanted to give like 10 different looks, different styles from the eras, and we have them in 3 sizes. If you go to petwigs.com, you can put in your email, and our store is going to launch in a couple of months.
Excellent. And you look very familiar. Can you explain why?
Yeah, I was on a show called The L-Word.
So how do you go from that to this?
Oh, I do a lot of different things.
But you must get a lot of feedback because you were iconic. You were like everyone's favorite character on that show, and you're very recognizable. So what did you get just walking around this place especially?
I'm with my people. We're just having a good time together.
I'm Drew Drogi, and I'm here, I think because of my Chloe 70 impersonation, or I don't know, because I'm an idiot in a wig. I don't know. Sometimes, not today.
What has your experience of DragCon been?
It's been great. Everybody's here. I can't believe how many people are here. It's a really great way to just connect. I've been meeting like fans from all over the world that are here. And it's just great to see everybody out. And it's also really positive. It's very happy here. And everyone's very supportive. And everyone's beautiful. So what's wrong with any of that?
My name is Big Dipper. I performed here at DragCon. I make music. I'm a rapper. I make music videos. I play club gigs. Yeah, that's about it.
And what is your favorite thing at DragCon?
Seeing everybody. Just sort of looking around. If you glance from left to right, you'll see like 10, 15, 20 people that you recognize from the internet, which is really rad.
And what do you think it would have been like to have a drag con when you were a kid? Because there are a lot of kids here.
I think it would be really cool. You know, I sort of had to like carve out my own understanding of culture. You had to find little pockets of it. And this is a really exciting place for everything to come together. So I think it would be really empowering if I was a young person, and there are a lot of young people here.
I'm Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and I'm here selling my brand at the RuPaul Drag Con.
Well, your brand's pretty fantastic.
Yes, the Supremes are quite wonderful. I'm glad to be a part of it.
Well, why do drag queens and gay people just worship the Supremes?
We all love glamour. That's it. We just love glamour.
What's your favorite thing here?
You know what I saw? There's this wonderful car. All Swarovski's, whatever, crystals. Oh, that's great.
That's a bling for you?
I love bling. Are you kidding? Hey.
I'm Andrew Christian, underwear designer. I'm here at DragCon promoting my brand and meeting lots of fun and interesting fans.
You have a really hard job.
It's very hard. You know, I get to hang out with all these hot models all day. They get to walk around in underwear. It's really difficult.
Is it weird to have everyone in your underwear?
It is. It's even more of like a weird thing when I'm halfway around the world and then I run into somebody who's like wearing my underwear. So it's really a good feeling.
Someone bends over to pick something up and suddenly you see your name on their butt.
It's nice like if you're in the locker room and like I see somebody wearing my brand.
That gives you an opening line.
Yeah, definitely.
You're in my shorts.
Right?
Reporting from the exhibition floor of DragCon 2016, at the Los Angeles Convention Center, I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Dyer V, Wenzel Jones, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Some of the music you heard came from a 1984 Tony Awards performance from LaKaja Fole, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show and the crew, a video teaser for our must-have LGBT History from Outlaws to In-Laws CD, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WDIY Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, KVSC St. Cloud, Minnesota, to ECR Eden, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It had and still has a powerful impact on the way people think and talk about race and inequality in the U.S. In 1965, the Moynihan Report was released, and the controversy it generated continues, in a sense, to this day. Daniel Patrick Moynihan was at the time an assistant secretary of labor in the Lyndon Johnson administration. He would go on to become a Harvard professor and a four-term senator from New York. The weird thing about the Moynihan Report is that while many liberals and leftists have embraced it over the years, many diehard conservatives have praised it as well. Why? How could a document about race and inequality and African-American life be read so differently? And how do contemporary racial discourses that point to, for example, a culture of poverty or to colorblindness, how do they relate to the claims made in the Moynihan Report? In other words, what can we learn from, as Daniel Geary writes, the astonishingly wide-ranging and long-running controversy over Moynihan's views of African-American families? Daniel Geary is Mark Pigott, Assistant Professor of U.S. History at Trinity College, Dublin. Shortly after the book, his book is Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. When Daniel Geary joined me shortly after the book came out, I asked him what happened in the arena of civil rights in the U.S. in the year or two before the Moynihan Report was released.
Yeah, this is a crucial period for civil rights in the U.S. because in 1964, you get the passage of the Civil Rights Act, which basically ends the Jim Crow system in the South and declares racial discrimination to be illegal. Moynihan is writing in the wake of that. He also sees on the horizon, although not yet passed, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which enforces the constitutional right of African Americans to vote, mostly in southern states where they've been denied the right. So Moynihan is writing in the wake of and anticipation of this legislation, and the question he's really asking is, now that we have civil rights legislation, are we going to have true racial equality? And his answer is no. And I think that's what makes the report so significant then now that Moynihan had his finger on, he wasn't the only one, certainly, but in a high placed position in the government, had his finger on this really key issue of how racial equality was to be achieved after the achievement of civil rights legislation. Now, the way Moynihan frames the question and his answer for it, I think, is problematic, but I think he's, in one sense at least, asking the right question.
What did the Moynihan report identify as the main obstacles to full racial equality?
Well, Moynihan made the, I think, fateful decision to focus on the family. The report officially titled The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. In one reading of the report, which has some validity, is that Moynihan was using family to try to highlight a broader range of issues, highlighting basically historic inequalities that went back to slavery, to Jim Crow, to urban migration, to discrimination, and that these were all, you know, cited in the family, and one could see what Moynihan saw as signs of family breakup or instability, namely high rates of female-headed families, high rates of out-of-wedlock births, that one could see this as a result, really a broader social and economic inequality. But at the same time, Moynihan suggested that family instability was the fundamental cause of persistent racial inequality. He uses the term fundamental. So in that sense, there's a different line of argument that by stressing family structure actually is crowding out a broad range of factors that are in fact creating racial inequality. And not only that, but highlighting what Moynihan saw as an issue among African Americans themselves, rather than, say, in a wider system of systemic racism.
I think he used the term tangle of pathology. So he was saying, he was arguing that family structure was at the heart of this?
He was. So by pathology, a term used by Moynihan, another sociologist at the time as well, what Moynihan was talking about there was that he saw family structure as the main cause of a host of social ills plaguing African-American communities, such as, you know, crime, drug addiction, juvenile delinquency, poor educational achievement, and the like. And Moynihan said, you know, at the heart of these problems really is family structure.
And in pointing to family structure, what was he focusing on? You mentioned female-headed families. Was that the key structural element, the key characteristic that he pinned his analysis on?
It was. I mean, Moynihan, his idea of what a family should be is that there should be a male breadwinner, and that women, at least when they had children of young age, should focus primarily on child-rearing responsibilities. He didn't have a problem with women working before or after they had children, but he thought when they had children, they should primarily be at home caring for their children. And so when Moynihan sees African-American families, he sees many that do not conform to this model. And in a sense, Moynihan is suggesting that the inability of African-American men to serve as breadwinners because of unemployment, because of discrimination, that this, to Moynihan, is the key marker of racial inequality.
In bringing up unemployment and discrimination, was he then arguing that some kind of jobs programs or other measures, new measures, needed to be instituted in order to benefit African Americans and to quote, fix these issues, these family structure-related issues?
That's a very good question, and in a sense, I think, a complicated one. The simple answer is yes, that Moynihan did hope for expanded jobs programs. He favored New Deal-style public works programs. He favored the government being an employer of last resort. But you won't find that suggestion in the Moynihan report itself, which doesn't contain any policy suggestions, which is part of the reason why it produced confusion later, but also because Moynihan was well aware that President Johnson had already rejected, as part of the war on poverty, a small direct jobs programs where the government would directly provide jobs to those who were unemployed. So Moynihan may have hoped for that personally, but he also knew that that proposal in the political context he was operating in was dead on arrival. And I think we also need, and I think some historians miss this point because they go back and say, you know, wasn't it great that there was this guy Moynihan in the presidential administration who realized, you know, the need for jobs creation? It's incredible to imagine a government official today making, you know, a similar kind of suggestion. But let's look at what Moynihan was operating in terms of a political context. And what he was operating in was the civil rights movement had been pushing the need for massive federal investment to improve the lives, not just of African Americans, but of all poor Americans. Massive investment in American cities in particular, as well as in poor rural areas. So in 1963, Whitney Young of the National Urban League had proposed a domestic Marshall Plan, you know, using the analogy of American spending to rebuild Western Europe after World War II. Shortly after the Moynihan Report was released, Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin unveiled the Freedom Budget, which was a $100 billion program over a period of many years to provide investment, social welfare, and jobs to all those who needed it. And compared to those kinds of far-reaching programs that the civil rights movement pushed, and which were in fact necessary if the U.S. was to achieve true equality, Moynihan's suggestion for, you know, some expanded jobs programs, you know, some system of guaranteed allowances, it looks like weak tea compared to what the civil rights movement said was necessary and what was in fact necessary.
Are we to understand that Daniel Patrick Moynihan, did not believe that government programs alone could solve a problem that he saw rooted in family structure?
I think he allows for that interpretation because even though he hoped in a sense that this would lead to new government programs, he was identifying a problem that in a sense he knew was so deeply seated within American society, I mean, structural racism, economic inequality, you know, that mild reforms of the kind that were politically possible and that he personally entertained as a member of the political establishment were not really going to solve this deep-seated problem. And so that sort of raises this question, well, if government can't really solve this problem, then who can? One possibility would be that the problem was simply an intractable one, which is a possibility Moynihan, in fact, considers at the end of the report. Another possibility, which Moynihan doesn't say himself, but which I think is contained in some of the logic of the report, in which many read into it, is that it would be up to African Americans themselves to solve this problem. And I think by identifying family as the key problem, Moynihan really leads into that interpretation because many Americans, you know, read the report and were likely to read the report as saying, well, if this is an issue of family structure, an issue of family morality, then what really can the government can do? Isn't it up to African Americans themselves to form stable families? And if that's the route to racial equality, then it puts the onus on African Americans and particularly on African American leaders to uplift poor African Americans.
Daniel Geary joins us. He teaches U.S. history at Trinity College Dublin. We were talking about his new book, Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Well, this message of self-help and self-reliance, this sounds very conservative that, you know, government can only do so much. In fact, government can do very little and should therefore do very little. And we have this community, this African-American community, that should really just pull itself up by its bootstraps. So how did conservatives greet the Moynihan Report in the, you know, the immediate aftermath of its release?
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue wasn't really about self-help at all, because if you look at what civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King or Whitney Young were saying, they actually advocate self-help. But what they're saying is, you know, African Americans can't help themselves unless they have the resources necessary to do so. So when conservatives start to say in 1965, I mean, it's an old argument, but in the context of post-civil rights legislation takes on a new meaning, when they start to say, well, really the answer is racial self-help, what they're actually saying is government either can't do anything, or really what they're saying is it shouldn't do anything. It's a rationalization of inaction on the part of white Americans. And conservatives immediately take up the Moynihan Report in this vein. One notably is William F. Buckley, who is running for mayor in New York City in 1965, and he picks up on some of Moynihan's analysis to make exactly this point. He says this is not a problem that government can do anything about. It's up to African-American leaders to solve this problem and to individual African-Americans themselves. And when he says these things, instead of, you know, denouncing Buckley, Moynihan actually gets behind him. And he even is reportedly says during the mayoral campaign that everything that Buckley said was a plagiarism taken from himself, taken from Moynihan.
So Buckley sees the Moynihan Report as a conservative document. And yet, as you point out in this book, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the prominent socialist Michael Harrington and many other people on the left embraced the report. For what possible reason?
Well, they see the report as arguing something different. They see the report as, in fact, a genuine case for national action, as a blueprint for government following up civil rights legislation and limited war on poverty with a genuine effort to combat poverty in the United States and to try to alleviate structural inequalities. You know, initially, not just King, but other civil rights leaders view the Moynihan Report in hopeful terms because they think that the presidential administration is finally getting the message that they've been saying for many years now, that some kind of massive redistribution of resources is necessary if true equality is to be brought about. And Moynihan, in fact, does recognize their argument and is speaking to it. So they're not wrong in seeing that aspect of the report.
So then what do we say of a report that can be interpreted in such different ways? I mean, how do we, you know, we like to put things in categories, right? We like to say, well, this is a radical proposal. This is a liberal document. How then do we assess and assign meaning to the Moynihan Report and what it aimed to do?
I think we have to say that the report is fundamentally ambiguous. It's a report that's produced at a, you know, quite particular moment of conflict. I think liberals such as Moynihan were in a position where they could genuinely understand what was necessary to achieve equality, yet at the same time, you know, weren't willing to go all the way to support these measures. And that produces this kind of ambiguous analysis that can be read in multiple ways. I mean, in some sense, this ambiguity is functional. It serves a function politically, both for the Johnson administration, because it seems to accept the validity of civil rights demands for economic equality without actually, you know, proposing any specific new programs. And it's functional for Moynihan in the sense that he is, you know, he benefits from winning acclaim across the political spectrum. I mean, part of his long-term political appeal is that he is someone who sort of transcends partisan or ideological divisions. And we can already see this with the Moynihan Report, which is really the thing that initially makes him famous, that his desire to transcend these divisions. So in my view, the report is ambiguous. It's neither liberal nor conservative, but in a sense both, or allows for both readings. And this explains a sort of long-term controversy over it, the fact that it can be read in many different ways.
The Moynihan Report was officially titled The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. It was finished in March 1965. It was made public in August 1965. And in November, the Johnson administration, the LBJ administration, disowned the report. Did that hurt Moynihan's career?
Initially, it certainly hurt him. It hurt him on a personal level. But in the long term, no, it didn't hurt his career at all. In fact, Moynihan, he had a PhD from Tufts University in political science and international relations, was a political scientist, he'd had no background really in the study of African Americans or of race in general, at least until he co-authors the book Beyond the Melting Pot with the sociologist Nathan Glazer. That's published in 1963. But prior to 1963, he has no claim to expertise on racial issues. And here he is writing a report on on a subject for which he has, you know, little expertise, the Negro family, the title of his report. But in effect, writing that report makes him into an expert on African Americans, what one of his critics called an instant expert on this subject. So in 1966, he's hired by Harvard University as a full professor, where he directs a center on urban studies. He is frequently consulted by the media to try to explain, you know, what's happening with African Americans, particularly in the context of widespread urban rebellions. And then in 1969, Richard Nixon hires Moynihan to be one of his top domestic advisors, all resulting from him, his fame as the author of the Moynihan Report. Later, of course, he goes on to a long career as senator for the state of New York.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Daniel Geary joins us. He's Mark Pigott, Assistant Professor of U.S. History at Trinity College, Dublin. And he's the author of Radical Ambition, C. Wright Mills, The Left and American Social Thought. We are talking about his new book. It's called Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. It's a history of the controversy over and the legacy of the 1965 Moynihan Report about African-American families. In a chapter of your book, Dan, a chapter titled The Death of White Sociology, you begin by referring to the disproportionate power that white intellectuals held to define African-American life. What's important to emphasize here?
Well, in a sense, Moynihan was a perfect example of this, and, you know, he's targeted for that, as I was just speaking about. You know, here's a guy who has little academic training, little personal experience with African-Americans, and yet, seemingly overnight, he's become one of the leading government and media experts on African-American families. We have to remember at this time as well that universities are largely segregated. I mean, there are a precious few African-American scholars at the sort of, you know, leading American universities. But by and large, African-Americans had been excluded. You know, so when you get the Black Power movement in the mid to late 1960s, and when you get the Black Studies movement, which is sort of an intellectual wing of the Black Power movement, you know, they're looking around and seeing just how much power white experts, people like Moynihan, have to define the terms by which African Americans are understood within the larger culture.
And so specifically, what did someone like Stokely Carmichael, leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, what did he say about the Moynihan Report? What was his reaction to it?
It's interesting because Carmichael actually refers to the Moynihan Report in the very speech when he introduces Black Power as the slogan that is now going to be used for SNCC. And what Carmichael says is, well, he says two things. I mean, one, he picks up a critique of the report that had been made by others, that the report blame the victim. That's the term used by Moynihan's critic, William Ryan, a white civil rights activist. And Carmichael agrees with this. He says, by pointing to alleged deficiencies among African Americans themselves, Moynihan was putting the responsibility on them to correct this problem rather than where it should lay on those who perpetrated inequality in American society. But secondly, Carmichael says, you know, who is Moynihan and who are these government experts to be talking about African-American families? This is not an issue that white leaders really understand, that they know anything about. This is an issue for African-Americans to talk about. And the fact that a group could have the very terms of their family life, something as intimate as that, you know, so casually and, in Carmichael's view, ignorantly discussed by the most powerful men in America, suggested how powerless they were in terms of their ability to define themselves in the wider culture.
Black Power advocate Julius Lester had some interesting and provocative and very sharp things to say about the report, didn't he?
Yes, Lester, in his wonderfully titled book, Look Out Whitey, Black Power is Gonna Get Your Mama, has a chapter entitled Bang Bang, Mr. Moynihan. You know, so he's literally, at least rhetorically, not literally, but he's rhetorically calling for Moynihan to be shot. And what Lester is suggesting there is similar to Carmichael, just the illegitimate power that Moynihan has to define African-American lives. And Lester takes particular issue with Moynihan, who he sees as a representative of sort of white liberals. And he sees them as a special problem because, as, you know, white liberals like Moynihan try to pretend that they are friends of African Americans and that they're friends of the cause of racial equality. They speak this language. But if you look at what they're actually saying, they're enemies. And not only that, but they really haven't taken the time to understand what African American life is like, to actually speak with African Americans themselves. And so, you know, Lester says, until people like Moynihan, you know, come and learn from African Americans, they should really be regarded as enemies.
Yeah, you write in your book that Lester posited that, quote, Moynihans, people like Moynihan, who pretended to ally themselves with African Americans, were more dangerous than open segregationists.
He does say that. He even says, you know, he says, well, if we're going to decide who we're going to shoot first, we should shoot the Moynihans before we start going after the white sheriffs. Now, of course, he doesn't mean that literally, but that suggests just how powerful his critique of white liberalism was. And I think that's, in many ways, characteristic of the Black Power movement.
Now, did some Black Power advocates actually approve of the Moynihan Report? And if so, why?
They did, because in some senses, what Moynihan was saying actually dovetailed with a lot of what at least male Black Power leaders were saying. You know, it was very common among Black Power leaders to talk about the emasculation of African American men and the need to restore male authority within the family. So one example of this is actually in the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam's paper, Muhammad Speaks, is very positive on the Moynihan Report. In fact, you know, initially says, this report basically just confirms what our leader, Elijah Muhammad, has been saying for decades. You know, he's been talking about the problems with female-headed families and out-of-wedlock births and about the need to restore men as heads of household.
And here, I think, basically what you're pointing to is the fact that Black Power, I mean, by Black Power as a movement, we shouldn't automatically conclude that everybody in that umbrella was on the radical left.
Or they weren't on the radical left necessarily on every issue, and also that there was lots of disagreement within the Black Power movement. Michelle Wallace, who wrote about the Moynihan Report, said that sort of all African Americans wanted to, I can't remember her phrase, but it's something like they wanted to cut out his heart and feed it to dogs. And that's, you know, certainly many African Americans had that negative reaction, but not all did. And some like certain aspects of the report, but dislike others. You know, some dislike the whole thing, some like the whole thing. But there's quite varied reactions among not just Black Power activists, but African Americans generally to the Moynihan Report. And I think that points to greater diversity within the movement than is sometimes recognized.
So you referred earlier to the push for Black studies. And among the African-American scholars who sought to use sociology to construct competing images of African-Americans, right? Images of African-Americans much different than those offered up by white scholars, was a woman named Joyce Ladner. What should we know about her?
I'm glad you mentioned Ladner, because I think she's an important part of the story, but one that, her role in this controversy has too often been neglected. So Ladner grows up in Mississippi. She becomes one of the young leaders of the civil rights movement there, working with SNCC and working with the NAACP. Then she goes to get her PhD in sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. And there her doctoral advisor is this guy by the name of Lee Rainwater. Rainwater was an ally of Moynihan's. He agreed with Moynihan's view on African-American families. He wrote about what he saw as the pathological culture that African-Americans had. He saw that as resulting from racism, but nevertheless described it as pathological. And Rainwater was actually the principal defender of Moynihan, at least within academic circles, along with his graduate student, wrote the first book on the Moynihan Report, Controversy, called The Moynihan Report and Politics of Controversy. That's in 1967. But Ladner comes to entirely different views from both her advisor, Rainwater, and from Moynihan. To Ladner, the tradition of sociology that that white scholars like Moynihan and Rainwater had propounded was one that offered a too pejorative a view of African-American communities, of African-American families that had sources of cultural strength that were not acknowledged, that had different cultural values when it came to family, and that African-American families should really be understood as part of a coherent cultural system with its own values, certain values which were superior to, you know, what she saw as the sort of white middle class model, which with its nuclear family units, that she found African American family structure more based on superior values of cooperation. So Ladner is sort of one of the key people who challenges this view that African American families and African American culture more generally should be seen as pathological.
Daniel Geary is his name. He teaches U.S. history at Trinity College Dublin. We are talking about his new book, Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy, published by University of Pennsylvania Press. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Dan about his really interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Daniel Geary is Mark Pigott, Assistant Professor of U.S. History at Trinity College Dublin. His interests include political ideologies and movements, the development of American ideas about race and ethnicity, and the history of the social sciences and their role in shaping public discourse and public policy. A while ago, I interviewed Daniel about his book, Radical Ambition. That's a book about the influential social critic C. Wright Mills. And today we are talking about a new book of his called Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. And that refers to the report put out by Daniel Patrick Moynihan in 1965. It was officially titled The Negro Family and the Case for National Action. So Joyce Ladner, who you were talking about before the break, she edited this landmark collection of black sociologists' work. It was called The Death of White Sociology, published in 1973. When did black sociology emerge, and what kind of impact do you think it had?
Well, it emerges in the late 1960s, and this collection, you know, in the early 1970s shows that it's, you know, sort of, let's say, at its apex in the early 1970s. And I think it had a very significant influence on the discipline of sociology. I mean, so black sociology is part of the broader black studies movement. Now, of course, sociology had a long tradition of providing academic analysis of race relations in the United States. So it's not an accident that many African-American scholars went into sociology. But black sociology suggested not that one needed to be African-American in order to understand African-American life, but that one at least needed to understand African-American perspectives, that one couldn't be someone like Moynihan, who had little personal experience of African-Americans and little, you know, interest in how they understood their own lives, but one needed to understand things from the black perspective, I suppose.
Scholars often like to represent their work as objective. Did black sociologists think that scholarship on African American life could or should be objective?
Some did. You know, some said that the sort of the white domination of the field and the previous inability to incorporate African-American perspectives that had made the field lacking in objectivity. But Many black sociologists said that objectivity was neither possible nor necessarily desirable. I think one says, you know, this is, if you're an African-American writing about what it's like to be an African-American, then this is obviously an issue of profound importance to your own life and the prospects of those that you know. So this is not something that you can be or would want to be, you know, wholly objective about. And they make the same point for, you know, scholars like Moynihan. They say he, you know, Moynihan was not offering an objective view of African-American families, but rather he's standing from a certain standpoint in society, one of white power and white privilege, and that shapes, you know, the view that he gives about African-American families.
And the standpoint of many white intellectuals, and you make this clear in your book, is that they compared, or I should say they evaluated African-American families in terms of whether or not they attained certain standards which seem to be often or always white middle-class standards and norms. Elaborate on this and tell us what the black sociologists and black studies scholars had to say about it.
Well, I think from the what someone like Moynihan would say about that is Moynihan would not accept that this was a white, you know, middle-class standard for him. You know, the idea of the male breadwinner family was a universal model that everybody should adopt. But from the perspective of those black sociologists who are criticizing Moynihan, you know, they suggest that this is not a universal standard, that this is, as you suggested, a white middle-class standard. There's a way in which they combine, you know, sort of race and class in a certain way because, you know, it sort of leaves out the white lower class or the black middle class, for example. But that we'll just leave that to aside for a moment and say, from their perspective, they say this is a white middle-class standard, and it doesn't really capture African-American families that need to be understood in their own terms, not for their failure to attain another model, but what is the family model that they actually have, and what are its strengths as well as its weaknesses.
So part of the project of this book is to see how the Moynihan Report, which was released in 1965, how it has been read over the decades, in fact, up till the present moment. And let's talk about William Julius Wilson, the very prominent sociologist. You write that he resuscitated the Moynihan Report in a certain political way in the 1980s. How did he read the report?
So Wilson is very much writing against the black sociologists that we have just been discussing. Wilson wants to revive the view that African-American culture and family life is pathological, and that this pathology results from deeper inequalities within American society. So to that extent, Wilson chooses in his 1987 book, The Truly Disadvantaged, he chooses to say that he is, in his own words, following the footsteps of Moynihan. Wilson is a liberal. I mean, in fact, he's a social democrat. He favors universal social programs for employment and other means of social welfare. And he sees the Moynihan Report basically as a liberal document. I think Wilson, you know, there's a lot that's good in his work. He really does effectively, you know, identify a lot of the social inequality in our society. He does a much better job than Moynihan, in fact, in explaining this, and particularly explaining it in the context of the effects of deindustrialization on the job prospects for African Americans. But I think Wilson made a mistake in adopting the Moynihan Report and wrapping himself in that mantle. He did so at a time when the Moynihan Report was widely celebrated by conservatives, and I think Wilson thought he could say to those conservatives, well, if you really care about African-American families, you have to support the kinds of social democratic programs that I do. But his argument didn't really work, and I think, moreover, the way that he used the Moynihan Report suggests Wilson's really dominant focus on African-American men, that by pointing to some of the same things that Moynihan did, you know, rates of female-headed families, that Wilson was suggesting that the problem really was with African-American men, and the solution was to provide African-American men employment. This suggested that, though he didn't explicitly say so, but that he supported the same kind of family model that Moynihan did, the male breadwinner model. But it also, I think, blinded him to other ways of tackling inequality, such as providing higher wages to women who are single mothers.
Dan Geary is professor of U.S. history at Trinity College Dublin. We are talking about his book, Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. We have a link to that book and to Dan's faculty page at Trinity College Dublin on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain. Well, you know, Barack Obama was influenced by the sociologist William Julius Wilson. So what stance has Obama taken on the Moynihan Report?
Obama has been a supporter of the Moynihan Report. He has, you know, his book, The Audacity of Hope, he specifically mentions the Moynihan Report by name. He says that those who criticize the report, referring, you know, partly to the black sociologist we referred to earlier, you know, were unfair and misguided when they criticized Moynihan. And I think, you know, one of the programs that Obama has supported in recent years is this program called My Brother's Keeper, which is designed to provide mentors to young men of color. And it suggests that he adopts the Moynihan Report's analysis in that it's family structure that's the problem, and particularly African-American men, other men of young men of color, the men that we need to worry about, and that the solution might come through the presence of role models. Now, there's nothing wrong in itself with providing role models to those who need them, but I think the problem with stressing that kind of approach is that it eclipses the need for what's really needed to combat inequality, which is, you know, a massive redistribution of resources in our society. So I think by supporting the Moynihan Report, you know, Obama is preferring individualistic solutions to racial inequality.
Would you say that Obama is part of the pathologist camp, the you know, the group of folks who kind of want to stress the pathology within African-American communities and families?
He certainly is. I mean, he's actually even, you know, he uses that language himself. You know, he uses the term pathology. So I think there's no doubt that he's in the pathologist camp and that he has followed Wilson in that regard.
And the emphasis on pathology, I mean, that makes me think of the concept of culture of poverty. Those three words have been thrown around a lot in the last many years. Tell us about that concept and to what extent we should link it to the Moynihan Report.
Yeah, I mean, Moynihan didn't use the concept himself in the report or the language, but it is closely linked as an idea. I mean, culture of poverty, that term was used by the anthropologist Oscar Lewis, who first used it to refer to Mexican peasants, who he studies anthropological work, and then later used it to refer to Puerto Ricans, both in Puerto Rico and Puerto Rican migrants to the mainland, United States. And what Lewis meant by the term was similar to what Moynihan had in mind. In fact, Lewis identified, you know, female-headed families as part of the culture of poverty, along with a series of other factors like alcoholism and an orientation toward the present rather than toward the future. But the key similarity, I think, is that Lewis saw the culture of poverty as something that was self-perpetuating and, in that sense, deep-rooted. Now, like Moynihan, like the Moynihan Report, the phrase culture of poverty or the analysis could lead in many different political directions. Now, Lewis himself was a socialist, and he supported the Cuban Revolution, among other things, and thought that organized action by the poor would be the surest way to get rid of the culture of poverty, and he certainly supported social democratic programs to do so as well. But of course, the analysis also had strong conservative implications or strong conservative uses, you know, where it allowed conservatives to say, well, the problem is a cultural problem. It's not a political problem. It's not a social problem. It's not a problem to do with exploitation or, you know, power relations in our society. The problem is flawed culture among the poor themselves, and therefore it's up to the poor to address this culture if, you know, they hope to succeed better.
Dan, in your book, you trace the conservative, among other things, you trace the conservative interpretation and conservative appropriation of the 1965 Moynihan Report. And I'd like to point to one episode that you bring up, which occurred on the 30th anniversary of the publication of the report. That's 1995. William Bennett, former education secretary under Ronald Reagan, he praised the Moynihan Report. On what grounds?
Well, Bennett says in 1995, he says that the Moynihan Report was a great document because it pointed to what the real problem was, which was a lack of moral values, a lack of family values. So, you know, Bennett was speaking the language of movement conservatism about the need to restore family values. And he was also saying that the problem was not racism. The problem was a lack of family values. Now, it is incredible. And Bennett then also says, well, there's nothing that government can do to restore family values. This is up to individuals and communities to do. Now, it's incredible that he makes that statement because Bennett, of course, had recently been the drug czar under the first President Bush. In that role, you know, he presided over the mass incarceration of African Americans, which, you know, if you wanted to point to one thing that was damaging African American families and communities in particular, you'd point to mass incarceration. So here, the engineer of mass incarceration is saying there's nothing that government can do, but what he's missing is what government was doing, what he himself was doing. And I think that's a, you know, we haven't talked about it, but that's a flaw in the way that the Moynihan Report sets up the problem. It says, well, here's a problem. Can the government do something? Can it not do something about it? Well, what about the things that government was doing that was, in fact, reinforcing racial inequality? I mean, there are a number of things the government was doing at the time. Moynihan was writing that he missed, such as redlining practices, which the federal government basically enforced racial segregation in housing and prevented most African Americans from being able to get a decent mortgage to buy a home. And here's Bennett, you know, framing things in the same term and then allowing to be ignored or missed the role that the government was actually playing in reinforcing racial inequality, and which had, of course, a direct effect on African American families. This is something, you know, that has been not Bennett's role particularly, but the importance of mass incarceration as an issue affecting African American families has been pointed to by Ta-Nehisi Coates in his recent cover story in The Atlantic, in which he takes up the Moynihan Report as a sort of framing device to tackle that whole question.
What about the question, the politics of colorblindness? Does that have its origins to some extent in the debate over the controversy around the Moynihan Report?
I think the Moynihan Report argument offers a kind of a necessary complement to ideas of colorblindness, because people are not blind. Everybody can tell that in the United States today there are vast disparities, vast inequalities, and that these inequalities map onto racial divisions. So if you want to argue that the United States has become a colorblind society, you know, that its laws are colorblind and that racial prejudice no longer exists, then you need an explanation for why obvious inequalities persist. And the Moynihan Report offers that an explanation that can be used in that way. It was not necessarily the way Moynihan intended it, but it can be used in that way because it says, well, inequalities persist because of the flawed culture that many African Americans themselves have and their failure to adopt the correct family values. So it explains why they remain unequal and why it's their responsibility, you know, not a problem with structural racism, because in this view, the U.S. has become a colorblind society.
I'm C.S. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Daniel Geary's new book is Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy. So, Dan, you write that even today, the Moynihan Report, this is 50 years on, remains a political litmus test. For what?
Well, I think it helps reveal political divisions. I mean, the report is still hated by many on the left. And it has its supporters among conservatives as well as among liberals. Although if you look at the way they read the report, you can tell the difference in their political divisions there. So, I mean, there have been numerous mentions of the report this year. Perhaps one of the most interesting ones was when the New York City Police Commissioner, Bill Bratton, you know, announced, this is at the end of August, he announced that over the weekend he'd read the Moynihan report and that this explained a recent crime wave in New York City. I don't know what he does on the weekend, but apparently he goes and reads 50-year-old government reports. And then Mayor de Blasio heard what Bratton had said about the Moynihan report, and de Blasio said, you know, that's nonsense. He said, this document is 50 years old. It has an antiquated idea about family, antiquated ideas about race. Some city council people attacked Bratton for, one attacked him for being, for using a report that they called racist. So it speaks to the passion that this report can still generate and the divisions that, you know, that you can see. I mean, in fact, Mayor de Blasio and the police commissioner, they are coming from different backgrounds. They probably have different views of things. They've tried to be allies. But here was an example where you could see the real differences between them, you know, how they were reading this 50-year-old document.
We've been talking a lot about how other people read and thought about the Moynihan report. And I want to ask about your opinion, and particularly your opinion of this notion that African Americans, their position in today's society, can be explained by family structure. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think the main thing that I would say, and the thing that I really learned from studying the Moynihan report and the controversy over it, is that this is the wrong way to start a conversation, you know, about racial inequality in our society. If we want to talk about inequality, you know, we should talk about things like taxes, housing, education, and where our society chooses to assign its resources, also about the long history of racism in this country. I mean, it's sort of incredible that people in 1964, 1965, you know, immediately said, okay, well, we've passed the civil rights legislation, so, you know, everything's equal now. I think we need to look at the history here. Of course, we should study African American families. We should study, you know, all families from an academic perspective. We should also understand how families are affected by inequality, you know, and what role family structure plays in that. But I think this is just the wrong way to go about having this debate. I mean, we have to remember, nobody asked Moynihan to write a report on the African American family. The question that Moynihan was addressing really was the question of racial inequality, why it was likely to persist after the civil rights era. I think the report has continued to be used so often because it provides different competing answers to that question, but it addresses that question. But if that's a question we want to ask, you know, why does racial inequality persist in our society, and why do other forms of inequality, class inequality, gender inequality persist, I don't think we should start that discussion with a discussion of family structure.
And you're right, and it's understandable given the way you've described the Moynihan report today that the left today has little to gain by appealing to the Moynihan report. Now, you're obviously on the left, so why write a book about a document that you really don't see has very much use to the left today?
Well, I think it's important to understand the Moynihan report, to understand the kinds of ways that Americans have gone about discussing inequality in our society in the past 50 years, the kinds of strategies that have been pursued, you know, throughout the political spectrum. You know, but also, you know, it is an argument with people like William Julius Wilson and others on the left who've tried to recover, you know, some kind of strong argument for government action from the report, and have celebrated as doing that. And I think that that's, you know, both misguided in terms of reading into the report a single meaning that it doesn't, in my view, actually have, you know, but also a flawed political strategy, because we see how easily these arguments are used by conservatives and how effectively conservatives have used it. So I think we should certainly understand the report, understand the arguments that it makes, understand the history of which it's a part. But I would be happy if we treated the document as effectively dead as offering any kind of blueprint for what we should be doing to solve our problems today.
Daniel Geary, Mark Pigott, Assistant Professor of U.S. History at Trinity College Dublin. We've been talking about his new book, Beyond Civil Rights, The Moynihan Report and Its Legacy, published by University of Pennsylvania Press. Dan, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.